Random House Audiobooks presents Tom Clancy's NetForce, created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachinik. Read for you by Carrie Shale.
Tom Clancy's NetForce. Tuesday, September 7th, 2010, 11:24 p.m., Washington, D.C. "Okay, Commander," Boyle said. "We're clear." Steve Day stepped out into the muggy autumn night from the cooler air-conditioned restaurant. The limo was there, but Boyle was a very careful young man, one of the FBI's finest. Day nodded at the driver, the new guy, Larry, Lou, something like that. He headed for the limo, achieved it, slid across the cloned leather seat. He was feeling pretty good. True, he was the commander of the recently established NetForce, but that didn't cut much ice when homespun rich senators or even richer foreign diplomats were in line ahead of you. Even restaurant owners in this town knew which backsides to kiss first. Still, the meal had been great. Boyle slid in next to Day, closed the door, then tapped on the bulletproof Lexan partition with one knuckle. The driver started the car as Day unclipped the Virgil from his belt and looked at it. His virtual global interface link, Virgil for short, had a flashing telephone icon in the upper right corner of the small LCD screen. He touched the icon, and a number blinked onto the screen. Marilyn, calling from home. The Virgil's speaker said, "Hi, Steve." "Hi, Marilyn, what's up?" "You coming home?" "On the way." He tapped the Virgil, reclipped it to his belt, then slid the Galco paddle holster with his SIG-40 around toward the front a little, so it wouldn't dig into his right hip. He could have carried one of the new model wireless KTs, kick tasers, that were supposed to be better than a gun, but he didn't really trust them. They were on the narrow street behind the new projects, the shortcut toward the expressway. There came a terrific bang, a flash that strobed the limo's interior a sudden bright orange. The car rocked up on the driver's side, hung for what seemed like forever on two wheels, then fell back and hit the street hard. Boyle already had his pistol out as the limo fishtailed, slewed, and slammed into a streetlight post. Day saw a bulky man in black run toward the car from out of the sticky night. The man wore a watch cap, pulled low but not covering his face. He had blonde hair, a scar running through his right eyebrow. He was smiling. "Out!" Boyle screamed. "He stuck a limpet on the door! Out!" Day grabbed the door handle on the driver's side and hit the ground in a sloppy shoulder roll. Boyle exited the car, gun working, tongues of orange fire stabbing into the dark, but it was like a slow-motion scene in a movie. He jerked as the small arms fire beat at him, blood and brain matter sprayed from the side of Boyle's temple as a bullet exited there. The mine attached to the rear door of the limo went off, blam. The car's roof peeled up a little in the back, leaving a fist-sized gap. The driver hung part way out of his window, boneless. Day came up, took two or three quick steps, jinked right for two more steps, then cut left. Gunfire tried to catch him, failed to connect solidly. A bullet tugged at his jacket, punched through under his left arm. A black figure appeared in front of him, waving a flashing Uzi. Still running, Day lifted the SIG, lined the glowing tritium dot on the front sight on the man's nose, and squeezed off three shots as fast as he could pull the trigger. The armored attacker dropped as if his legs had vanished. "Now, go through the hole, fast, head for the goal line." Day felt his bowels clench. This was a hit, an assassination, and they were good. It was his final thought. The bullet hit him between the eyes and took away everything else he might ever think. In the back seat of the Volvo station wagon, Mikhail Ruzio looked into the cargo compartment behind him at the body of Nicolas Paprosa. Ruzio would miss him. They went back a long way, to the days in the Foreign Intelligence Service, the SRV. 15 years, a lifetime in this business. In the front seat, Winters, the American, drove, and Grigory Zumeya rode in the passenger seat, mumbling to himself in Russian. Ruzio looked down at the pistol on the seat next to him, the one with which he had killed the man who had killed Nicolas. It was a Beretta 9mm, an Italian weapon. He frowned at the Beretta. The Americans had this obsession with size. To them, bigger was always better. They did not seem to understand that a single shot from a small caliber weapon in the hands of an expert was much more effective than a magazine full of elephant-killing bullets in the hands of an untrained idiot. But at least the FBI man had died well. He had taken one of them with him, and that had been unexpected. In the front seat, the snake muttered something, loud enough for Ruzio to hear. Ruzio did not like Grigori the Snake. The man had been in the army in 1995, one of the units who stomped into Ruzio's homeland of Chechnya to kill and rape. One of these days, Ruzio would smile while he throttled the stupid oaf. Not today, however. There was still much to be done, and the snake was still necessary, which was lucky for him. Alexander Michaels was only half asleep when the small monitor on the nightstand next to his bed lit. The screen's blue NetForce background came up, and the computer's vox said, "Alex, we have a priority one comm." The computer's voice was throaty, sexy, feminine. No matter what it said, it always sounded as if it were asking you to go to bed with it. The deputy commander of NetForce rubbed at his face and sat up. "All right, I'm up. Connect comm." The screen flowered, and the somewhat harried face of Assistant Deputy Commander Antonella Fiorella appeared. She looked more alert than he felt, but then she had the graveyard watch this week.
"Somebody just assassinated Commander Day. Bombs and submachine guns, looks like. Maybe 20 minutes ago."
"I'm on my way."
"Virgil's got the address."
A short pause.
"Alex, don't forget the assassination protocols."
She didn't need to remind him of that, but he nodded. In the event of an attack on a senior federal official, all members of that unit had to assume it might not be the only attack planned.
"I copy that. Discom."
His assistant's image vanished, leaving the NetForce blue screen. He slid off the bed, stepped to his dresser, and started pulling on his clothes. Steve Day was dead? Damn. Wednesday, September 8th, 12:47 a.m., Washington, D.C. Red and blue lights from the D.C. police patrol cars strobed the street with primary carnival colors, an effect appropriate to the circus of activity now upon it. It was a bad neighborhood to die in, Tony Fiorella thought. But then, any neighborhood was a bad one to die in when death came from a hard and sudden sleet of submachine gun fire. The new Chrysler Town Car glided to a stop just outside the police barricade. Alex Michaels alighted, saw Tony, headed for her. Tony felt that mixed rush of emotion she always felt whenever she saw Alex for the first time on any given day. Even in the middle of all this carnage, there was a certain amount of joy, of admiration, even of love.
"Tony."
"Alex."
They didn't speak as they toured the murder scene. He squatted and examined Steve Day's body. After he'd gotten as good a look as he wanted, Alex turned to her.
"Okay, lay it out."
"A bomb under a manhole cover kicked the limo into a light pole. The door in the rear was blown open, probably a marine limpet of some kind, and the passengers were cut down by several attackers." She kept her voice level, as if talking about ballgame stats. It was tough to keep the emotion from her words. She'd liked Steve Day and his wife, but it was her job. "D.C. police have set up roadblocks."
Alex waved this off. "This was a professional hit. The shooters won't get caught in a roadblock. What else?"
"Until we get the lab work, I'm afraid that's about it."
He nodded.
"All right. Steve, Commander Day, ran organized crime for a long time. Crank up the system, Tony. I want to know everything about everybody Day ever talked to in his tenure at OC. Anybody who had a grudge. And anything current we are working on. This looks like a new mafia operation. It's their style. But we don't want to overlook anything."
He stared at the street, but his eyes were focused on something a million miles past it. Steve Day was dead. It hadn't really sunk in yet. He'd seen the body. Seen that the light behind Day's eyes was gone, leaving nothing but a shell, a hollow form where nobody lived any longer. Intellectually, he knew it, but emotionally, he was numb. He'd known other people who had died, some of them close to him. The reality of it never became true until days, weeks, months later. Damn it. Somebody had put out a good man's lights.
snuffed him like a blown-out match, and all Alex Michaels was left with at this moment was the burn of his own anger. He sighed. There was nothing else to be done here. The killers would be a long way away by now, and all the door-knocking and witness interviewing wouldn't turn up anything immediately useful. NetForce had access to the highest technological resources on the planet, the fastest computers on the net, a wealth of information beyond measure, and none of it would help if the assassins hadn't made some kind of mistake. Now and then, they did slip up, and if they'd made the slightest slip here, something so small it could only be seen with an electron microscope, Alex Michaels was going to move the entire solar system, if necessary, to find it. His Virgil cheeped.
Yes.
Alex, Walt Carver. Walter S. Carver, director of the FBI. He'd been expecting the call. Michaels gave his boss what they had.
All right, we've got a meeting with the president at 0730. You'll be doing the presentation. Oh, and as of now, you're acting commander of NetForce.
Sir, I...
Carver cut him off. I need you here, Alex. You aren't going to let me down, are you?
No, sir.
Good man. I'll see you in the morning. Alex shook his head. About the time you thought you were in control, life sure had a way of setting you straight.
Think you're in charge, pal? Here, chew on this. Your immediate superior just got murdered, probably by the mob. You just got promoted, and tomorrow a presentation to the most powerful man in the world will probably make or break your career. How does that make you feel?
Like shit.
A traffic cop nearby said, "Excuse me?"
"Nothing,"
Michaels said. He headed for his car. "Home, Commander?" his driver said.
Commander. The driver already knew about the promotion.
"No, to the office."
Wednesday, September 8th, 11:19 a.m., Grozny, Chechnya. Vladimir Plekhanov wiped some of the ever-present dust from the inside of his window and looked down upon the city. From his vantage point in the corner office, on the sixth floor of the computer wing of the science building, formerly and briefly the military headquarters building, he had a good view. Here was the new downtown bridge over the Sunzia River. Way over there, the massive Makhachkala pipelines, delivering their ever more precious black fluid to the waiting tankers on the Caspian Sea. The flare stacks at the refinery ran day and night, spewing fire and smoke into the skies. But in the not-too-distant future, those fiery towers would go dark. Chechnya needed a new base for its economy, a base that he, Vladimir Plekhanov, was going to provide. The sound of his computer's telephonic program interrupted Plekhanov's musings upon his grand plan.
"Computer, sound dampers on."
The machine hummed and obeyed the Vox command. The communication was secure, as much so as the best Russian military encryption program could make it. Plekhanov knew this because he himself had written the program under contract to the Russian army.
"The job is done,"
said the voice from thousands of kilometers away. Mikhail, amusing himself by using the name Ruzio, thus Mikhail the Rifle. A violent man, but loyal and most adept.
"Nicholas unexpectedly decided to retire."
"How unfortunate. You have moved into the new quarters."
"Yes."
Even though the link was encrypted, old habits died hard. Plekhanov knew that the hiding place was San Francisco, so there was no need to say it aloud.
"Continue as planned. I will contact you when further work is required."
Plekhanov leaned back in his chair. The grand plan progressed exactly as he had intended. Like a snowball rolling down a hill, it had begun small, but by the time it was done, it would be vast and unstoppable. He pushed the intercom buzzer on his desk. A few seconds passed, and nothing happened. He pushed the button again. Still no response. He sighed. The intercom was broken again. He was on the way to being the most powerful man in the world, and he had to work in an office wherein the simplest devices were in need of repair. He shook his head. That was going to change. Wednesday, September 8th, 7:17 a.m., Washington, D.C. Alexander Michaels was tired, had drunk too much coffee, and he wanted nothing more than to find a bed far away from all this and sleep for a week. Virgil cheeped as the car approached 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Alex, you ready?
Yes, sir. I should be there in about 5 minutes.
Anything new I should know about?
Nothing substantial.
All right, just come. The procession arrived at the west gate. Alex alighted, was checked by the metal detectors, bomb sniffers, and an HOS, a hard object scanner. This latter, a new device designed to keep ceramic or plastic guns and knives from sneaking past. A final check, the thumbprint scanner, and the door opened to admit Alex. Inside the Situation Room, Director Carver was already seated at a long table shaped like the office above the room. Standing to his left was NSO Assistant Director Sheldon Reed, making a call on his Virgil. A middle-aged secretary in a tweed skirt and white silk blouse sat at a small table off to the side. The President and his Chief of Staff, Jessel Leon, entered the room.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've got a busy schedule, so let's get right to it. Walt?
Mr. President, you know Alex Michaels. I've bumped him into Day's chair. He'll lay out the situation as we now know it.
Okay, let's hear it.
Michaels began to lay it out. The explosion, the attack, the dead and suspected dead. After 10 minutes, he paused, looked around the table.
Any questions so far?
Anybody step forward to claim responsibility?
No, Mr. President.
Anything on the bombs? Reed asked.
Israeli small marine surplus, about 5 years old. No prints or DNA dregs on the expended brass, all of which was identical. Ammunition appears to have been factory-loaded 9mm Luger FMJ round nose and would have been subsonic from either a pistol or a submachine gun.
Who did it, Mr. Michaels? Who are they going to come after next?
Computer image 12, Michaels said.
A holograph appeared, showing a scene recorded in daylight.
This is an FBI archive image of the scene of the killing of Thomas Big Red O'Rourke in New York City last September. The method of attack was remarkably similar. A bomb went off under the Irish mobster's armored limo.
There have been other killings like that, haven't there?
Yes, sir. Joseph D'Amato of the Dixie Mafia in New Orleans and Peter Heitzman in Newark. The FBI's organized crime unit believes the hits were ordered by Ray Genaloni, head of the New York City Five Families.
The President nodded.
So it looks like what we're talking about here is mob-related.
Carver said, Commander Day was head of the FBI's organized crime unit for several years. During that time, half of the major New York families were arrested, and half of those were convicted and put away. The President stood, glanced at his watch.
It looks like this is some kind of mob thing, and while I regret the loss of Commander Day, I can't see that national security is at risk here.
With that, the President and his Chief of Staff left.
All right, we'll start some heat Genaloni's way, Carver said. The man won't be able to pee without somebody watching him from inside the bowl.
Yes, sir.
That's it. I want situation reports daily, sooner if anything breaks.
Not until he was back in his car and well away from the White House did Michaels allow himself to relax. This high-level stuff was risky. He would rather be in the field, training new agents, anything, than playing with politicians and security advisors. So now, aside from his personal agenda, he had it straight from the top. Find out who killed Steve Day. Find out. Or else.
Wednesday, September 8th, 9:30 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Tony Fiorella was in the small gym practicing jurus when two members of the newest class of FBI mainline recruits came in. She shifted into a right front stance, most of her weight on her forward foot, knee bent, did the windshield wiper-like two-handed block to control the center, left, right, then shot her right elbow upward in a short, tight strike to an imaginary opponent's head. This was the first juru, and a very simple sequence. One of the newbies, a tall, muscular man in blue spandex bike shorts and a matching FBI trainee T-shirt, looked at Tony, then chuckled, and said something to his buddy. The second newbie was a short and compact man, a bit on the pudgy side, with a thick bar of eyebrows. He laughed in return. She figured spandex for one of the Korean styles, eyebrows for a Japanese or Okinawan fighting form.
She saw Spandex grin, then launch a flying, spinning back kick. Right out of a bad action movie, she thought. She kept her pace even, trying to pretend she didn't notice them. Her expression gave her away, though. She couldn't stop the smile completely. Spandex caught it, and he was not pleased. "Something funny, ma'am?" He had a strong southern accent. Alabama, Mississippi, maybe. "No, nothing funny." Eyebrows decided this was a good time to jump in. "My friend here has a second-degree black belt. I bet he could teach you some things." "I'm sure he could." Might as well shower. She wasn't going to be able to concentrate with these two bozos flexing and being macho. "So, what is that little shuffle thing you were doing?" Spandex said. She turned back to face the pair. "It's called a juru. The style is Pukalan Penchak Silat Bukti Negara Serak." Spandex gave her a big grin. "Sounds like some kind of Thai food with peanut sauce." Another day, in a better mood, she'd have smiled and shaken her head and turned away, let the boys have their fun. But right now, she didn't much feel the milk of human kindness flowing through her. So she said, "I'm sorry your education has been so narrow. Tell you what, why don't you come over here and see if you can hit me? And I'll show you how my little shuffle works."
"Oh, I don't think so, ma'am. I wouldn't want to hurt you."
"I don't think it's likely." Spandex walked closer. When he was about 3 meters away, he stopped, bowed, dropped into a narrow horse stance, edged forward, hands lifted, one high, one low. "You ready?" She almost laughed. Might as well send her a telegram. "Oh, yeah." He probably expected her to step back and parry, but that was not how it went in her version. She double-blocked with both hands open, set her left foot down in a front stance, and ducked under his outstretched arm as she swung her right elbow into his ribs, under the armpit. At the same time, she reached up and across with her right hand and laid it on his forehead, elbow down. Spandex went down like a chainsawed redwood, hit the mat flat on his back. The entire sequence had taken just under 2 seconds. He rolled up and started for her. "Bitch!" As he launched a left jab to set her up, she stepped outside with a two-handed block, alligatored his arm with both hands just above his elbow, pivoted, dropped all her weight to one knee, and pinwheeled him. Tony came to her feet, waited to see if he was going to try a third attack. Spandex was not so foolish. Tony felt pretty good, despite knowing she should not have felt that way. Alex Michaels leaned against the wall, watching her.
"Very interesting," he said. "It's called Silat? Where did you learn it?"
She wiped at her face with a towel. "There was a little old Dutch Indonesian woman who lived in my neighborhood when I was about 13. It's a very scientific art, based on leverage and angles. It assumes you'll be fighting with multiple opponents, all of whom will be bigger and stronger than you. Normally, women didn't get into it very far, but Guru De Beer's husband traveled a lot. He wanted her to have something to protect herself. It's real primal stuff, designed for one thing, to cripple or kill an attacker. It's not civilized. It's as deadly and efficient as they could make it."
"Interesting."
She grinned. "What you saw here? That was the Bukti, the simple stuff. The parent art, Serac, is a whole new ballgame. Really nasty, and a lot of weapon work. Sticks, knives, swords, tridents, even guns."
"And you're supposed to be a nice Italian girl from the Bronx."
She laughed. "Okay, so what's up? You didn't come here to watch me beat recruits up, did you?"
"No, it's business. We've got another problem. Somebody just blew up the main subnet server at the NetForce post in Frankfurt, Germany."
"You mean the CIA post?"
"Right. NetForce being chartered to operate in this country only. Of course, what I meant was the CIA listening post."
That got a grin from her. There were no borders on the net. The web stretched everywhere. And while you could access most of it from anywhere, certain systems were easier to log into with a certain amount of proximity. The CIA was willing to lend its name to NetForce from time to time in exchange for certain favors they couldn't get on their own. The CIA wasn't supposed to operate within the United States, but nobody really believed it did not.
"Let me clean up, and let's go see," she said.
Wednesday, September 8th, 10 a.m., Sarajevo. an incoming tank buster rocket hit the building behind Colonel John Howard's Net Force strike team, no more than 20 feet above their heads.
"Reeves and Johnson, flank left,"
Howard said. It wasn't necessary to yell. All of them wore Loser headsets built into their helmets. He could have whispered, and they'd have heard him loud and clear.
"Odom and Vasquez, suppressing fire. Chan and Brown, go right. On my command, 3, 2, 1, now."
Odom and Vasquez opened up with their H&K assault subguns, unleashing a canvas-ripped full-auto barrage of high-cyclic 9mm from 100-round drum magazines. Howard popped up and shoved his Thompson submachine gun over the top of the dumpster, cooked off several 3-round bursts at the hidey hole where the guy with the rocket launcher was. The Tommy gun was definitely low-tech, an antique built in 1928 and had first belonged to an Indiana sheriff during Prohibition. They called it a Chicago typewriter in those days.
"No time for a stroll down memory lane now, John. Duck."
The grenade Reeves tossed into the stairwell went off. More shrapnel spanged against the dumpster, and the stink of burned explosive washed over Howard, along with smoke and dust. 2 seconds passed. All shooting stopped.
"Clear!"
Johnson yelled. Colonel Howard stood.
"Good job, people, but let's move. We got 6 minutes to get to the rendezvous point."
The team started to move out. Abruptly, the men, the street, the buildings faded. They went ghostly, transparent, then blinked out.
"Priority call, John," a crisp military voice said.
Howard blinked, raised the VR I-band, sighed. He was in his office at the Net Force HQ, and the firefight in Sarajevo had been a computer simulacrum, not a real battle.
"Put it through," he told his computer.
The head and shoulders image of Net Force's civilian commander, Alexander Michaels, appeared over Howard's desk.
"Colonel, we have a situation I thought you might want to monitor."
"The explosion in Germany?"
"Yes."
"My people are already aware of it. Are we talking about an insertion here?"
"Not in Frankfurt, no. It's too late for that. Better make sure your strike teams are ready."
"My strike teams are always ready, Commander."
"I didn't mean to imply otherwise, Colonel. I'll keep you appraised. Discom."
"Sir."
When he went online, Plekhanov still used old-style helmet and gloves, even though the newer systems didn't need either. These days, holoproj imagery could englobe a viewer's field of vision with a simple eyeband no wider than a pencil. But he liked the gloves, was used to them. He didn't care what anybody said. 45 years of muscle memory just didn't go away and allow itself to be replaced by something else simply because the new method was more efficient. He waved the web to life, said,
"Olympic Peninsula Trail."
The VR gear took over, produced an image of a temperate rainforest, a narrow path bounded on the sides by tall Douglas fir, thick ferns, and patches of assorted fungi, mushrooms, toadstools, and the like. Plekhanov was dressed in sensible hiking clothes, a khaki shirt and shorts, knee-length polyprop socks, waffle-stomper trail boots. In his day pack, he also had the sealed packet he was to deliver. After walking briskly for a time, he stopped and had a drink of water. While he was resting, he examined his watch. The device was a match to the one he had carried for more than 15 years, a Russian analog mechanical pocket watch. He thumbed the button, and the hinged cover popped open. He looked at the Roman numerals. Almost time for his meeting at the big rock on the coast. He needed to hurry. At the rock, a massive chunk of weather-beaten stone near the juncture of the Pacific Ocean and the Straits of Juan de Fuca at Cape Foulweather, he would deliver his packet to a courier. A small animal darted across the path in front of Plekhanov, a rabbit, or perhaps a raccoon, and there was a commotion in the ferns as the creature passed through. The man smiled. This was one of his favorite trips. Naturally, such musings turned his attention to technology and the uses to which he had been putting it of late. Most of it had been in VR or sublinks. Not all, of course. Sometimes the real world needed real actions. The physical destruction in Germany of the CIA Net Force post had been one such action. Crude, but necessary. the kind of software and viral attacks he was about to launch on systems in several of the Commonwealth of Independent States, in the Baltics, and even a Korean or Japanese system or two, just to keep people guessing. Well, these would be of a different nature. When chaos came, his talents were going to be in great demand. And who better to fix things than the man who knew exactly how they'd been broken? He laughed aloud. It was good to be in control, and it was going to get better very soon. Tuesday, September 14th, 11:15 a.m., New York City. Ray Genaloni put the phone's receiver down gently.
Excuse me, but isn't this supposed to be a secure line?
He pointed at the flashing red diode on the little electronic tap detector connected to the telephone's base.
That doesn't look particularly secure to me.
Luigi Sampson, his enforcer, shrugged.
The feds, they got stuff we can't get commercially.
Genaloni ground his teeth together. He mentally counted, slowly.
1, 2, 3.
He had been working to control his temper for most of his 40 years, and he was a little better at it than he used to be.
4, 5, 6. All right,
Ray said, feeling a little more in control, even if his anger was still hot and churning in his belly.
All right, Lou. Who's behind this?
It's coming out of the FBI's net force. Somebody knocked off their head guy in D.C. last week. They're looking at us for it.
Did we do it, and somebody forget to tell me?
We didn't do it, boss. Whoever cooled the FBI guy used the same M.O. as our ICE team.
So the question is, who's trying to put this one on us?
I don't know, Ray. We got our people looking, but no leads yet.
All right, keep at it.
After Sampson had left, Ray touched a control on the chair and allowed the motors to rumble and massage his aching back. He didn't need this kind of problem. The legit enterprises now brought in more money than the gray biz. One more generation and his family would be respectable. And respectability was worth it, even if he had to kill a bunch of people standing between you and it to get there. Tuesday, September 14th, 8:15 a.m., San Francisco. Mikhail Ruzio stood on a street corner in Chinatown and smiled to himself. He was no country Ivan come to a big city for the first time. He was a man of the world. He had spent time in Moscow, Paris, Rome, Tel Aviv, New York, Washington, D.C. But none of those places were home. Where he wished more than anything to be was at his small farm on the outskirts of Grozny. Anna was 5 years gone, taken by the cancer that had eaten her life all too quickly. At least she had not died in pain. Plekhanov had seen to the doctors. Ruzio would always be in the Russians' debt for his help during Anna's final days. What he wanted was impossible. The farm was still there, his brother working it, but Anna was not. No, he could not go back to the life he had lived before. Never again. The communications device Plekhanov had provided for him buzzed on his belt. He pulled the comm unit from his belt.
Yes, there is another job, Plekhanov said. I understand. I shall contact you later to supply the details.
I am ready.
Plekhanov disconnected the link. Another job. Fine. He was ready. He was always ready. The secure line bleeped, and Maura Sullivan waved her hand over the phone to activate it.
Yes.
You know who this is?
It was Luigi Sampson, Genaloni's enforcer.
I know who this is,
she said.
Would you be available to perform a service for us in the near future?
I can make myself available.
Good. If you would stand by for the next week or so, we will pay your customary advance against the service fee.
The Selkie smiled. Her standby advance was $25,000 per day, whether she did a job or not. $175,000 just to be available for a week. Another 6 or 8 months, and she would be able to retire, to leave the game. And there she would be, not yet 30, wealthy. Nobody would have a clue who she had been in her previous life. Nobody would ever suspect the petite, red-haired Irish woman, daughter of an IRA man who didn't have two nickels to rub together when he died, of being the Selkie, the highest-paid freelance assassin on the planet. Her mother, bless her, had been a hard-headed Scot and had taught her children, all seven of them, to value a shilling. Sullivan smiled again. That was where she had come up with her nom de mort, from her mother. The Selkies were the seal folk, full of the wear, able to shapeshift from men to seals and back again. Nobody knew who she was. She had never met a client face to face save once, and that client was no longer among the living. She was a faceless assassin, and it seemed she was about to go out on the hunt again. Thursday, September 16th, 6:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. One of the reasons Alex Michaels liked the condo in which he lived was the size of the attached garage. It was a two-car unit, and there was plenty of room for his hobby, which had been, for the last month, a 13-year-old Plymouth Prowler. It was essentially a slicked-up hot rod, a rear-wheel drive, two-seat convertible roadster painted a brilliant, deep, rich color known as Prowler Purple. What it really was a big kid's toy. Some kids grew up wanting to be cowboys in the Old West of the 1870s. Michaels had wanted to be James Dean in the post-World War II 1950s. He smiled as he rubbed creamy gray degreaser into his palms, then over the rest of his hands. Stuff had that sharp, perfumed stink that reminded him of Granddaddy Michaels, who had started to teach him how to work on cars when he'd been 14. The doorbell rang. Must be his driver. He was early. He wasn't supposed to show up for another half hour. He reached for the intercom.
Larry?
Not that I noticed.
Tony?
Yep.
Come around to the garage. I'll let you in.
He hit the control for the electric gate lock that allowed access into his yard, then tapped the garage door opener as Tony rounded the corner.
Wow. So this is the new car.
She stepped into the garage, put one hand on the right rear fender.
It looks great. What brings you here so early?
We've had some developments, she began. His house phone rang.
Just a second. Hello?
Hi, guess who?
Susie, how are you?
Great, Dadster. Mom said I should call and thank you for the skates.
For a moment he went blank. Then the empty spot was filled with panic. Her birthday was yesterday. Jesus, how could he have forgotten that?
How was the party?
It was terrific. Even Tommy Jerkface Stupid Dumbhead came.
Michaels grinned. At seven, no, eight now, Susie had never been shy in expressing herself. Tommy must be the new boy she liked. The worse the names, the more the like.
When are you coming out to visit, Dadster?
Soon, baby. Soon as I can get loose.
I gotta go. I just heard the microwave go off, so the waffles are done. I love you, Dadster.
I love you too, Susie. Say hello to your mom for me.
Bye.
How'd she like the skates? Tony said.
You sent them?
Well, yeah, I hope that was not a line.
Not at all. You saved my butt.
I'm still your assistant.
He became aware they were standing only half a meter apart. She was an attractive woman, and he wanted to hug her, but he was her boss, after all, and he was afraid the hug might be misinterpreted. Tony felt a stab of disappointment. She had felt the heat in him, thought for just a moment he might reach out to her. Wishful thinking, Tony. Still, his gratitude had been real enough. You want the bad news or the worse news? Thursday, September 16th, 7:35 a.m., Quantico.
Colonel, I think maybe you ought to saddle up,
Michaels said. John Howard sat forward in his office chair, his back suddenly straight and tense.
According to a coded message intercepted by the CIA listening post at the U.S. Embassy in the Ukraine, a physical attack is planned on the station there, likely in the next few days. We'd like two things. One, you take a platoon or so of your best to augment the Marine Guard at the embassy. Two, and more importantly, we wouldn't be real unhappy if you could find out who's behind it.
I'll have my teams in the air in 30 minutes, Commander Michaels.
Your contact at the embassy will be Morgan Hunter, the CIA station chief, but it's your operation.
Sir.
After he hung up, Howard couldn't keep the grin from his face. Finally, a field operation, and not a virtual one, the real thing. He found himself breathing faster, and with a sudden urge to visit the bathroom. This was it.
Time to rock and roll, he said to the air. Rock and roll!
Thursday, September 16th, 8:15 a.m., Quantico. In his office, Jay Gridley prepared to ride the net. Cyberspace wasn't really like the old movies that had first depicted it, Gridley knew, but virtual reality constructs, VRCs, did use imagery to help a web walker navigate the web. He did the finger weave to access the command mode, waved the web to life, and said,
Dodge Viper, Bavaria.
The VR gear gave him an image of a mountain road in a somewhat stylized German landscape. He was inside an RT-10 Viper, a black convertible roadster with broad white racing stripes, driving down a steep switchback. Eventually, he would have to program himself a female passenger to complete his scenario. A sultry redhead, perhaps, or a dark and deadly brunette. Around the next curve, the mountain road turned suddenly into an autobahn, with traffic zooming past at speeds in excess of 160 kilometers per hour. He was in the netstream now, his program running smoothly. A sleek Jaguar passed the Viper, and Gridley smiled at it.
Oh, yeah?
He goosed the Viper, felt the jolt of acceleration even in sixth gear as the car surged forward. He flew past, saw the frowning driver's face. Gridley grinned. The Jag didn't have any more, and the Viper wasn't even close to redlining the tack.
So long, pal.
He was still feeling pretty full of himself when he saw the wreck about half a mile ahead of him. A big semi had flipped and turned onto its side, the trailer now blocking all the lanes on his side of the freeway. Traffic was now at a standstill on his side of the highway. Gridley braked and vaulted over the Viper's low door. He'd just mosey over to the cops and see if he could find out what was going on. Tyrone Howard rode the net, wind blasting his bare face. Well, bare except for the old-style aviator goggles he wore. He pulled the bike onto an off-ramp, geared down, rolled into a parking lot, and all of a sudden, he was back in his room. He heard the front door open.
Tyrone?
Hey, Pop.
When he reached the living room, he saw his dad there, in NetForce fatigues, neutral gray pants and shirt over spit-polished black boots. Behind his father, Master Sergeant Julio Fernandez stood by the door, dressed similarly. Fernandez had retired from the regular army at the same time Colonel Howard had left. They went way back, had known each other for 20 years. They'd joined NetForce at pretty much the same time.
I wanted to stop by before we took off, his dad said. I don't know when I'll be back. You take care of your mother.
His dad squeezed his shoulder once more, then did a crisp pivot and headed for the door. Tyrone felt a sudden coldness in the pit of his belly. For his dad to come home when he didn't have to pick up any gear or anything, just to tell him goodbye, well, that made Tyrone nervous. Thursday, September 16th, 9:15 p.m., Grozny, Chechnya. Plekhanov was in his office in front of his computer. His communication software had connected him to the rifle.
Are we clear on what needs to be done, Mikhail?
Da, we are clear.
Good hunting, then.
Thank you.
Plekhanov leaned back in his chair and considered his next action. So many small details that must be attended to if the plan was to continue to work properly. Thursday, September 16th, 10:15 a.m., San Francisco, California. Ruzio felt a little better. It was always good to have a specific chore, a job to be done, regardless of the constraints. Now he had to call the Snake and the Texan and get them set. This would be tricky, and in one way, probably more so than the assassination of a federal agent, but not so dangerous. This time, they would have the law on their side, in a manner of speaking. Thursday, September 16th, 1:15 p.m., Quantico. In his office, Commander Alex Michaels frowned at the young man sitting across the desk from him.
All right, Jay, what exactly does this mean?
Gridley shook his head.
I don't know, Chief. I went for a ride on half a dozen major highways, netways, and there were wrecks on all of them.
But we're not talking major sabotage.
Jay shook his head. Well, sort of, and no. No piece of it was a biggie, but taken all together, it adds up to major. Whoever built this program is good, real good, because he slipped it past a bunch of safeguards, and the only people who caught him was us.
So, NetForce systems were unaffected.
Yep. Guy's not as sharp as he thinks.
For no reason at all, Michaels had a sudden flare of suspicion.
Unless he wanted us to think he couldn't get past our guards.
Once the young man was gone, Michaels leaned back in his chair and pondered the situation. He felt as if somehow NetForce was under attack. It could be nothing more than professional paranoia, of course. That went with the job. But if it wasn't, if somebody was out to damage NetForce, who was it? And more important than that, why?
Friday, September 17th, 5:01 a.m., in the air over Northern Europe. Colonel John Howard leaned back in the jetliner's seat and nodded at Sergeant Fernandez next to him. Probably one of the smartest things NetForce had ever done was to lease several 747s, then outfit them for fast tactical flights.
Okay, Julio. Let's run through it one more time.
Sir, Ukraine is about the size of France, holds 52 million people, has an elected president, and a 450-person parliament called the Verkhovna Rada. The U.S. embassy is in the capital of Kiev. This time of year it's still warm, though mostly overcast and about to get rainy. About 75% of the population is Ukrainian, 20% are Russian, the rest are Jews, Bielorussians, Moldovans, Poles, Armenians, Greeks, and Bulgarians. Counting yourself, there might be three people of African descent in the country. You will draw a crowd on the streets, sir.
Go on.
Money is the hryvnia, and one of ours will get you two of theirs at the legal exchanges. The most useful phrase you'll want to know in Ukrainian is «Probachta, dihovalichi toilet».
Which means?
Excuse me, but where is the men's bathroom?
Fernandez droned on, but Howard was only listening with half his attention. There was no better man to have at your side or watching your back than Julio Fernandez. He had trouble working a computer that a 6-year-old could operate with ease, but when push came to shove, he was the best. He could pin a fly to the wall with his throwing knife, then shoot its eyes out with whatever hardware he happened to be holding, either hand, and you pick 'em. A bunch of half-baked local radicals were about to discover that making threats against a United States embassy was an extremely stupid idea.
Friday, September 17th, 1:25 p.m., New York City. Luigi Sampson, security chief for Genelone Industries, exited the Midtown Chinese restaurant, flanked by two bodyguards. In the plain, one-color four-door sedan across the street, Ruzio looked at Winters, the driver, then at Grigori, the snake, seated in back.
Are we ready?
I am ready,
the snake said. Go to it, Hoss.
The three of them wore identical charcoal suits, not too expensive ones, with shined black leather shoes, dark sunglasses, and new short haircuts. In addition, each of them carried cards and badges that identified them as special agents of the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation.
All right, let us go.
As Ruzio and the snake drew near to the trio, Sampson said,
Good afternoon, boys. You guys were the bureau, right?
He smiled at the two guards to show how adept he was at recognizing federal agents. Ruzio affected the flat Midwestern American accent he had practiced.
Luigi Sampson, I'm Special Agent Arnold. This is Special Agent Johnson. We'd like you to come with us and answer a few questions. Sure thing, boys.
To the nearer guard, Sampson said,
Verification.
The bodyguard had a small computer flat screen he tapped commands into.
They're on the list.
In the back section of the car with the snake, Sampson said,
So, what's it all about, boys?
Ruzio looked at Sampson. You are criminal scum, and you will pay for it very soon. Sampson laughed.
Yeah? Well, you're stupid if you think that.
No, you are the stupid one. You believe we are with the FBI.
What the hell's going on? Who are you? What do you want?
To feed the wolves a poisoned bait.
Friday, September 17th, 2:30 p.m., New York City. Ray Gentiloni was mad enough to kill somebody with his bare hands.
What exactly do you mean the FBI doesn't have him?
We sent the lawyers, boss. The feds say they didn't pick up Luigi.
But you and Randall say they did.
Their ID's checked out. They're on the New York Bureau list. The car they were in had no hit plates.
Then why are they telling the lawyers they never heard of him?
I don't know.
Gentiloni sat silent for maybe 15 seconds. He saw the bodyguard sweat. Finally, he said,
go find something to do.
After the bodyguard left, Gentiloni sat and stared at the wall. What the hell were the feds up to?
We'll just see about this crap.
He picked up his phone.
Scramble, code 2435, Sunshine.
Scrambled.
He punched in a number.
We'll just see about this crap.
I understand, Maura Sullivan said, knowing her voice would not give her away. She waved the phone off, stood, began a measured pacing. The Selkie did not sit and meditate. She could become anything, anybody, and the world was her chew toy, but this would be a dangerous one. There could be no room for error. Killing her target would not be the problem. That was the easy part. An assassin who was willing to be caught or to die herself could pretty much take out anybody in the public eye, from the president on down. Getting away with such an assassination was another thing, especially when the best and brightest lights of the top anti-crime organization in the world would be shone into your escape tunnel. Before she left, she would take on a new identity. She would become a woman who belonged in Washington, D.C., who had reason to be near her target, who would pass any inspection if necessary. She was a creature of the wear. She could change her look as easily as some people changed their clothes, could become anything she wished. Already, the Selkie's metamorphosis had begun. Saturday, September 18th, 4:19 p.m., Los Angeles. Ruzio stood on the moving walkway at the Los Angeles airport, heading for the car rental pickup. The business in New York had gone well. Less than 24 hours after they had kidnapped him, Luigi Sampson was no more. Well, Ruzio thought that was not strictly true. The chopped-up pieces of the criminal were by this point a semi-liquid goo inside a large glass-lined holding tank of a very strong acid. The FBI thought Gentiloni had killed one of its own, and Gentiloni thought the FBI was out to get him. The former was incorrect, but the latter was now true. Giving one's enemy something else about which to worry was an old but still useful device. There were other small things Ruzio and his crew could do to further harass both NetForce and the criminal family they had set upon each other. Small things, but each adding a bit more to the load. These things they would do. Sunday, September 19th, 2:30 a.m., Kiev. John Howard was just a little peeved at the CIA station chief. Morgan Hunter was maybe 45, hair gone gray but still in pretty good shape, to judge from the fit of his suit and the way he moved.
I'm sorry, Colonel, but what can I say?
They were in the small conference room in the sub-basement, a room Howard had been given for his operation. Howard was making ready to reply when Julio Fernandez entered the room.
Sir, we might have something. Lucy Jansen, third team, made friends with one of the guys on the shortlist. They connected in a local bar, and after 5 or 6 glasses of vodka, the guy let it slip about having an old wire-guided missile launcher he was going to have a chance to use real soon.
Howard felt himself ratchet into alertness.
Go on.
Lucy is working the guy. She's going to get back to me in a couple of hours.
Maybe it was nothing, but Howard didn't think so. All of a sudden, he had a fluttery sensation in his belly. This was it. This would lead them into the radical's den. Sunday, September 19th, 11:05 a.m., Washington, D.C. When the phone rang, Alex Michaels was in his garage working on the prowler.
Dadster?
Hey, little bit. How you doing?
Mom wants to talk to you.
He took a deep breath.
Sure. Put her on.
Bye, Dadster.
Bye, little bit.
Alex?
Hi, Megan. What's up?
I know you put your job at the top of your list, but your daughter still thinks the moon rises in her father's shadow. Are you going to be able to break loose and come to her play?
I'll be there.
You sure?
I said I'd be there.
Listen, there's something else. I'm seeing someone. I wanted you to hear it from me.
The coldness in his belly hardened into shards of liquid oxygen, so frigid they stopped his breathing.
Anybody I know?
No, he's a teacher at Susie's school.
Congratulations.
We aren't about to get married, Alex. We're just seeing each other socially. You've been dating, haven't you?
He waited just a little too long before he replied,
Sure.
He still missed Megan, despite all that happened. She'd been the love of his life. She always would be.
I have to go. Tell Susie I love her.
Alex.
He put the phone's receiver gently back into the cradle. Maybe there was a magic spell somewhere that would erase all the bad between them. Maybe there were some magic words that would put them back together as they had been when Susie had still been in their future. Maybe there were such words, but Alex Michaels had not found them. Sunday, September 19th, 11:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tony Fiorella had just gotten off the phone with her mother, a Sunday morning ritual that usually ran 20 or 30 minutes before Mama began getting antsy.
This must be costing you a fortune, baby.
As she was putting the dust mop away, the phone rang. Was that her mother calling back for something?
Hello?
Subcommander Fiorella?
Yes.
This is Jesse Russell. We, met the other day.
A southern accent, the voice. Wait, she had it. Spandex.
Ma'am? Sorry, Mr. Russell. Never mind. What is it you want?
Well, ma'am, I wanted to apologize for that business in the gym.
It's all right, Mr. Russell. Forget about it.
I'm rusty to my friends. You going to be at the gym Monday?
Unless something comes up.
I'll see you there.
She found herself smiling as she put the dust mop away. Most people deserved a second chance, most of the time, and he wasn't all that bad looking either. And who knew but a good-looking student might not give Alex a jolt, show him Tony was somebody to look at. It couldn't hurt. Sunday, September 19th, 11:15 a.m., Quantico. Jay Gridley had spent a good part of the last few days cruising the net, looking for more roadblocks. He upshifted, felt the Viper strain to be released, let it go as he pressed the accelerator to the floor. He surged the little car from 60 to 90 in a couple of seconds. Ker-wham.
Born to be wild, and if you can't drive it, pal, park it.
He pulled alongside the black kid on the bike, grinned, honked his horn. In reality, the two of them were linked via the net in a real-time online connection. But the VR visual mode made it so much more fun when the software allowed for overlapping scenarios like this one.
Hey, Tyrone.
The kid looked over and grinned.
Hey, JG, what are you doing here?
Looking for trouble. I need to ask you something.
Sure, no prob, Jay.
No prob. Jay considered it for a moment. Ah, no problem. He was 28, but talking to a kid like Tyrone made him feel like a pile of dinosaur bones. Then again, kids who rode the net seriously saw and heard things that adults missed, and Gridley wanted to use every resource he could get his hands on. He put his blinker on and pulled into the exit lane. Sunday, September 19th, 10:45 p.m., Washington, D.C. It was a quiet Sunday evening, the fall air still warm and sticky with humidity. Alexander Michael's condo was dark, save for a light in an upstairs bedroom. A plain vanilla, government-issue, black-tire Fedmobile with two FBI agents in it sat parked at the curb across the street. Now and then, one of them would glance at Michael's place, or up and down the street, checking auto or foot traffic. The Selkie walked along the sidewalk, approaching Michael's condo. She had already examined the agent's car with a 12-power Spook Eye monocular. The shotgun mic in her purse had sufficient electronic amplification so that from 100 yards she'd been able to hear the soft twang of country music from the surveillance car. The mic was disguised as a hearing aid, and the scope passed as a small can of hairspray. Anything less than a determined search wouldn't know these things for what they really were. When she was 50 yards away, she saw the agents glance in her direction, then back to their chess game. She kept her expression neutral, even though she wanted to smile. They had seen her and dismissed her. She wore an ankle-length cotton print dress, a thin cotton sweater, and stout, sensible lace-up Rockport walking shoes over black knee socks. Her hair was white and fluffed up into a rounded perm. The latex mask and makeup she wore had taken her an hour and a half to apply and should pass inspection from 5 feet in broad daylight. She was Mrs. Phyllis Markham, retired from her job of 41 years as a bookkeeper for the state government at the Capitol in Albany. Mrs. Markham's daughter, Sarah, lived in Philadelphia, and her son, Bruce, was the manager of a Dodge truck dealership in Denver. Her background was all in place, and any kind of computer check would vet it. She could bore the leg off a clothes store dummy, reciting it in her dull and scratchy voice, too. She didn't know if the guards were permanent. Probably not, but it didn't matter. Two men in a parked car on a street were not much of a threat. Now they had seen her as she wished them to see her. She would be back in the morning, again at night, for at least the next week, perhaps longer. The target would probably die quietly in his bed one night in the next week or two, with nobody the wiser. The old lady could circle around the condo after the deed was done, walk right past the agents assigned to watch the target, and they would never have a clue. By the time anybody knew the target was dead, the old lady would have ceased to exist. Monday, September 20th, 8:17 a.m., Kiev. Colonel Howard had just finished a field strip and reassembly on the H&K G3A3Z assault rifle. He wiped excess dry lube from the weapon and put it back on the table. Maybe he should clean his handgun, too. All right, he was fidgety. They had a location on the terrorists, and a meeting was supposed to take place for the leaders of the group at 11:30 hours. Once the woman trooper had gotten the drunk to an empty room, he had been relatively quick to volunteer that information. It was a 20-minute drive to the warehouse district where the meeting was set. Allow twice that for traffic problems, plus a half hour for X-Factor, which meant they should roll at 0900. Fortunately, Howard's appearance wasn't going to be a problem. A local bus had been secured, and he could sit on an aisle seat where nobody would notice him from outside if they bothered to look. And since everybody inside the bus was working for him, about 25 troops, that wouldn't be a problem. There was no reason for Howard to feel as nervous as he did, but that didn't matter. It might not be a major firefight in a jungle somewhere, but it was very possible bullets would fly and men would die. And it was his responsibility. He most assuredly did not want to foul it up. Monday, September 20th, noon, Grozny, Chechnya. Vladimir Plekhanov sat on a mossy rock next to an old-growth tree, drinking cool water from the bottle he carried, enjoying a shaft of early sunshine that had angled in under the thick fir canopy. His musings were interrupted by the arrival of the Ukrainian. His footsteps made no sound on the soft path, but he did not look at ease as he moved. He spotted Plekhanov and nodded. "Greetings," he said in Russian.
"Have a seat."
The Ukrainian shook his head.
"I need to get back soon."
"You have news for me."
"The Americans have discovered the location of those planning the attack upon their embassy in Kiev."
"Took them long enough. Perhaps we should be less subtle in our clues."
"I don't understand why we did not simply allow the attack to go forward."
Plekhanov smiled.
"That band of fanatics is a loose cannon, overfilled with explosive powder. Sooner or later, it would have gone off and done as much damage to those nearest it as any target. We need such things removed from our deck, and the Americans will do that for us."
The Ukrainian bowed slightly, a military gesture done mostly with the head.
"As usual, Vladimir, you are correct."
Plekhanov held up one hand, gestured toward the trail.
"Good to see you again."
After the Ukrainian had gone, Plekhanov inspected his pocket watch. Perhaps a quick walk on that side trail he had been meaning to explore. Yes, why not? Things were unfolding more smoothly than even his best-case scenarios. Indeed, they were. Monday, September 20th, 7 a.m., Quantico. Alexander Michaels sat in the stern of the houseboat, watching a brown pelican dive for fish. Pelicans were saltwater birds, he believed, but he liked their look, and so had included them in his scenario. A small, flat-bottomed, green-anodized aluminum batteau approached from a side channel.
"Permission to come aboard, Captain?"
Michaels shook his head in mild amusement.
"Granted."
He waved at a deck chair.
"Have a seat."
"Thanks."
After Jay sat, he said,
"We've come up against a bunch of dead ends so far. The sabotage links bounce off in all directions, and that's real interesting."
"Go on."
"Well, what that means is that the rascals came from more than one locus, like we figured. So the actual piece is played by an orchestra and not a solo artist."
"So we're talking about one programmer or team and a wide distribution of software."
"Yep."
Michaels smiled.
"You recognize the programmer's style?"
"No. The firewalls are off-the-shelf, NetSoft, bulletproof. Anybody could install them. But the trails leading to the walls, they're all different, but they're different in similar ways. They have a rhythm. We're talking about a single conductor directing the orchestra. I'd bet my paycheck on it."
"Not a major surprise."
"We're running the signature and looking for matches, but there are hundreds of thousands of professional programmers out there."
Michaels nodded.
"All right, keep looking."
"If this guy uses the same setup he's been using, we should be on him like ketchup on fries pretty quick."
"But you don't think he'll use the same setup?"
"Nah, I wouldn't. And this guy's almost as good as I am."
Michaels laughed.
"Hey, it's hard to be humble when you're great."
Gridley looked at his watch.
"Whoops, better shove off. I have a staff meeting in half an hour."
Monday, September 20th, 11:50 a.m., Kiev. The terrorists' meeting was supposed to begin at 11:30 hours, but Howard had allowed 20 minutes more for late arrivals. That extra allotment of time was now up. There were 18 men and 3 women inside the warehouse, and while none of them had openly carried weapons, several had worn long coats, and at least 3 had arrived bearing what appeared to be cased musical instruments. Howard would be very surprised if those cases contained anything a musician would use on stage. The terrorists were in an office on the second floor of a small and apparently otherwise unoccupied two-story warehouse. Howard had his troops deployed around the building, watching all possible modes of egress. He would prefer not to do any shooting outside if it came to that. However, he was prepared for that eventuality. There was still just the one guard watching the only unlocked entrance. Howard watched from his vantage point across the alley from the south entrance as Fernandez approached the closed door. Fernandez did not wear any obvious weaponry, just a dark and greasy coverall, a battered yellow hard hat, and he carried an old metal lunch pail. Fernandez banged on the door with his free hand. After a moment, he hammered on the door again, and it accordioned up about 6 feet. The guard, unarmed, stepped into view, rattled off something. Fernandez said something in return, and it had a familiar ring to it. Howard grinned. If he wasn't mistaken, Fernandez had just asked the guard where the men's bathroom was. Fernandez said something else short and pointed behind the guard. The man turned to look, puzzled. A tactical error. Fernandez swung the lunch pail and slammed it into the guard's right temple. The man dropped as if his legs had suddenly vanished.
"A and B teams, go!"
Howard said into the Loser tactical comm unit he wore. He grabbed his H&K assault rifle and sprinted for the door. Monday, September 20th, 11:53 a.m., Kiev. From the time Julio Fernandez knocked the guard cold until the two assault teams were in place inside the warehouse had taken slightly less than 45 seconds. Now they waited. The only way down from the second floor consisted of 2 sets of stairs. The exit door on one set of those stairs was padlocked from the outside. The other set of stairs was wide and straight, the door unlocked. This was how they'd gone up, and this was how they would come down. Once most of the plotters were down, they'd move on them. They'd see they were caught and that resistance was unwise. If he could take them all alive, that would be the best thing. Let the interrogators at them. The sound of voices talking in Russian or Ukrainian drifted down the stairs. This was it. Howard took a deep breath.
Don't screw this up, John.
Monday, September 20th, 1:53 a.m., San Diego. Ruzio sat upright in bed, heart pounding rapidly. He kicked the covers off, swung his legs over the edge of the bed, stood. The nightmare woke him frequently, and often in a room in which he had never slept before. He turned on a light, stretched, sat on the floor, began to do crunches, working his abdominal muscles. He would do 100 of these, then push-ups, 100 of those, then another set of crunches and push-ups, and another, until he could not do even one more exercise. Sometimes that helped. Sometimes he would be tired enough to fall back into exhausted slumber. Sometimes it merely left him exhausted, but still awake. Those were not the best of times. Nor, unfortunately, were they the worst of times. Monday, September 20th, 11:54 a.m., Kiev.
Now,
Howard said into his mouthpiece. As he spoke, he stepped out from behind his cover and raised the assault rifle to hip point.
Don't move,
he yelled, using the Ukrainian phrase Fernandez had taught him. For a heartbeat, that's what happened. Then, one of the terrorists screamed something and pulled out a small, chrome-plated pistol. Most of the other terrorists tried to get their guns out. One of them saw how stupid this was, yelled, "Nyet! Nyet!" But too late. Howard's orders to his troops had been clear. Take them alive if possible, but if somebody is going to get shot, do not let it be you. Even amidst all the gunfire, obscenely loud in the enclosed warehouse, he distinctly heard the sound of men yelling and brass clinking on the concrete floor. Howard noticed his ears were ringing, and the stink of burned gunpowder filled his nostrils. Jesus! His troops moved, covering the surviving terrorists. Two had made it up the stairs, only to find the other exits blocked. Hands raised, they came down the stairs again. When the smoke cleared and the counts were done, of the 21 terrorists, 9 were dead, 6 were wounded, 4 with survivable injuries. None of Howard's troops had sustained a scratch. They had about 10 minutes before the local authorities would have to quit pretending they didn't know anything and take action.
Pack it up,
Howard said to the troops. His adrenaline was fast fading. He felt tired, old, and suddenly depressed. This wasn't a battle. It had been a complete rout. These so-called terrorists had never had a chance. Still, he hadn't screwed it up. That was something. Tuesday, September 21st, noon, Quantico. Tony Fiorella was practicing Sempok and Deepok, moves that allowed a fighter to go quickly from standing to sitting positions while keeping a defense. She was breathing hard and working up a pretty good sweat when Jesse Russell came into the gym.
Hey, Mr. Russell. Rusty, please. All right, Rusty. What, do I call you in class, as a gesture of respect?
The term we use for teacher is guru, she said.
He smiled.
Really? Are you serious, Rusty, about learning?
Yes, ma'am. This in-your-face stuff sort of came as a surprise. I'd really like to learn it.
All right. There are three things you want to remember. Base, angle, and leverage. I'm going to demonstrate the first juru. Watch me, and then we'll break it down.
He nodded.
Yes, ma'am.
Tuesday, September 21st, noon, Quantico. When Alex Michaels bothered to eat lunch, he usually ate it at his desk. Days when he just had to get out of the unit for a few minutes, he skipped the deli order and the NetForce cafeteria and went to the new restaurant Row a couple of miles away. Today the weather was a little crisper than it had been, not quite so warm and muggy, a good day for pedal power. He changed into bike shoes and shorts and a t-shirt in his office, stuck his taser into a small fanny pack with his ID and Virgil, and put his foam helmet on. He walked outside to the bike and trike racks, unlocked his trike, and wheeled it out into the parking lot. He checked out at the gate, headed for the bike path. He passed a few people he knew from the base, out jogging on their lunch hour, and he waved or nodded at them. He came up behind one young woman in a red Speedo tank top and matching skin-tight shorts with a fanny pack slung at the back, going at a pretty good rate in his direction. She was in great shape. He admired the play of her taut legs and backside as she ran. He checked her in the handlebar mirror when he passed, but he didn't recognize the face. The path, a nice smooth macadam, meandered through a small stand of hardwood trees whose leaves were fast changing from greens to yellows and golds, then swung past the back of a new light industrial park, mostly office buildings or jobbers' warehouses. He pushed and pulled hard on the pedals, the toe clips allowing him to apply pressure in both directions. The burn increased, but he kept pumping, holding on. When he had about 150 yards before the curve, Michaels allowed himself to coast. He slowed, added a little brake, and made it through the curve. It felt good to get out, to do something physical. He resolved to do it more often. Tuesday, September 21st, 12:09 p.m., Quantico. The Selkie slowed her run to a walk as soon as the target was out of sight on his big trike. He had seen her, of course, and given that he was a normal heterosexual male, he would have noticed her in the tight red shorts she wore. She could have killed him when he went past, could have easily pulled the snub-nosed .38 S&W revolver from the fanny pack she wore and put all five rounds the little gun carried into the target's back. But such killings were inelegant. Anybody could point a gun and blast away, and for an adept, there was no joy to be found in such a simple method. She nodded at a jogger coming from the other direction, but didn't make eye contact. Good assassins deleted their targets and got away. The best assassins could delete their targets and arrange it so nobody even suspected there had been a murder. That was much more satisfying. She hadn't been given instructions about the manner of this target's death, and she was toying with the idea of making it look like natural causes, or maybe suicide. She was in control. It was her choice. Always. Wednesday, September 22nd, 9 a.m., Washington, D.C. The buzzer sounded, and Tyrone Howard joined the exodus of students from first period class into the dingy green halls of Eisenhower Middle School. Ahead of him, he saw Sean Hughes lumber into a guy from behind and shoulder him aside.
"S.A. is on a roll today, ain't he?"
Tyrone looked to his left, saw James Joseph Hatfield grinning at him. S.A. came from the initials S and A, which came from Soras, which came from Brontosaurus, which was what the computer set called Sean Hughes, an ox pushing 6 feet tall and 200 pounds. Jimmy Joe was a hillbilly from West Virginia. Small, so white he was bright. Eyes so bad he had to wear thick glasses instead of contacts. He was also one of the best net riders in the whole school, and he was Tyrone's best friend.
"Hey, Jimmy Joe, how's the flow?"
"DFF, Tyrone."
This stood for Data Flowing Fine.
"Watch it, tits."
Tyrone backed up two steps, fast. He hadn't been paying attention. S.A. must have forgotten where he was going and stopped to puzzle it out. Stupid. But maybe not as stupid as walking right into his back.
Sorry,
Tyrone said.
"Yeah, you gonna be,"
S.A. began.
"I'm gonna mush you, monkey fingers."
But before he could finish the threat, Belladonna Wright walked past, trailing the scent of some musky, sexy perfume. Jimmy Joe grabbed one of Tyrone's arms and steered him back the way they came.
"Ride, rider, ride! Time his brain clicks back online, we need to be scanning elsewhere."
Tyrone understood. He wasn't ready to die, but sooner or later, he was going to have to do something about S.A. What to do, and how to do it? Well, those were the problems. Wednesday, September 22nd, 6 a.m., San Diego. It had been yet another bad night for dreams. After managing to get back to sleep for an hour or two, Ruzio came awake and knew it was pointless to try again. He sipped his bad coffee and shook his head. Just as well there was no news of home, given how dreary it all seemed. His comm unit cheeped. He sipped the coffee and stared at the comm. No, it did not matter. And just as well. More wet work was surely about to be forthcoming. Wednesday, September 22nd, 4:45 p.m., Washington, D.C. Naked, save for a sweatband around her head, the Selkie sat at the small kitchen table and examined her cane.
Every couple of months, she would take fine sandpaper and Watco satin finish oil to the cane to smooth and polish the already smooth hickory. The guys who made the wooden weapons did excellent work. She owned five of their canes in three different styles, as well as two sets of Eskrima sticks and a custom-made pair of six-inch shirawas. The weapon looked okay, so the Selkie left the kitchen and padded, naked, into the living room of her rental condo, where she had set up her practice target. A thin nylon rope ran from the target's eye bolt through a second eye hook she'd screwed into a ceiling rafter. The other end of the line was tied to a doorknob. This way, she could adjust the target's height. Right now, it was at knee level. Knees were great targets for a stick. A broken knee put a big crimp in anybody's fighting style. She whipped the cane up from the floor in a short arc from her right, slid her right hand to mid-shaft to guide the strike, her left hand to the carved grip to power it. The solid thunk of the wood into the padded bar felt very satisfying. A good hit. It was just practice, but even so, the Selkie was in the zone. She was in the killing zone, and there was no place more exciting. Monday, September 27th, 3 p.m., Maintenon, France. Plekhanov sat in an old stone French bell tower, a long-barreled Mauser, Gewehr model 1898 rifle balanced across his knees. The church steeple offered a good view of the approaching armies. The AEF, American Expeditionary Force, had come late to the Great War, but they were here now and would help turn the tide. Recent storms had been torrential. It was one of their brigades, slogging its way across the muddy fields, even as Plekhanov watched. Along with the Americans was a polyglot combined unit comprised of Russian, Serbian, Chechen, Korean, Japanese, Thai, Chinese, and Indian soldiers. Plekhanov's research was not as thick as it might have been, since it wasn't really necessary. The scope was zeroed in at 100 meters, so he aimed a bit high, for the head, to allow for a little extra drop. In New York City, a currency tasking computer subcontracted to the Federal Reserve sent copies of all user ID codes to every connected terminal. Even as the fat American collapsed, Plekhanov put the crosshairs on the throat of a white Russian, held his breath again, fired. In Moscow, the computer interlink responsible for balance of trade statistics with the European Commonwealth scrambled and went down. And here on the muddy French field was an Indian looking for a place to hide.
Sorry, Punjab, old man. There is no cover there.
The newly installed computer traffic system in Bombay blew its triple redundancy circuits. All 200 main traffic signals under its direct control turned green. All passenger and freight train track signals turned green. So did all light rail crossing signals. One unfired bullet remained. Plekhanov swung the rifle's barrel to the right, where the Siamese commander held a pistol, firing it wildly. Plekhanov grinned.
Aim. Squeeze.
The Thai Prime Minister's collection of personal pornography, most of which showed recognizable images of him in sexual congress with women not his wife, somehow uploaded itself from his home computer and into the mainframe of the Southeast Asian News Service. Below, and still 100 meters distant, the enemy soldiers milled around in panic. Enough damage for one day. He shouldered the rifle by its sling and headed for the tower's steps. Monday, September 27th, 8:11 a.m., Quantico. Jay Gridley pulled the Viper to a halt on a long and relatively straight stretch of the new Thailand-Burma highway. A reporter stood next to a smoldering limo with a bunch of cops making notes on a little flat screen.
Hey, Chuan, how's it going?
Jay, what are you doing here?
Just cruising. So who's the cookie in the shake-and-bake portable oven there?
A mess, isn't it? Our beloved Prime Minister Suko. Somebody got past the security on his personal system and then became very clever with the nasty pictures hidden therein. Gave them to my bosses. And two jumps later, on the international screen, instead of Malaysian Prime Minister Mohammed doing a nice ribbon cutting for our new rec facility at Cyberjaya, we gave our viewers Suko on a big round bed with two very naked Bangkok working girls. Hey, you ever been to Cyberjaya? In RW, I mean. They say that's where Cyber Nation's programmers came from.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
Anyway, so much for the sordid tale of a political career gone south. I gotta get back and file my story. See you, Jay.
Jay considered the situation. So Thailand was going to get a new prime minister. That might or might not have much effect on the world, but he had to figure that whoever was doing this had picked his targets carefully. To what end, Jay didn't know, but his gut feeling was that it was a real bad end. He'd better get back himself. The boss would want to know about the newest developments. On the way, however, something else caught his attention.
Holy shit!
Alex, I think you better see this.
Michaels looked up, saw Tony in his doorway, in the conference room. The big screen viewer was on, CNN. Two buses had crashed together in an intersection in Bombay, India. Bodies were laid out along the narrow street's narrower sidewalks. A small boy sat on the curb, staring at a woman lying next to him, who was obviously dead. The voice of the newscaster was almost matter-of-fact. All over the city, computer-controlled traffic signals apparently turned green at the same instant only minutes ago. Another image, a major intersection with at least a dozen cars melded together by impacts. Again, the image shifted, showing a train station. Freight cars were scattered among the passenger train cars, some of them turned onto their sides. Another scene shift. A twin-engine airplane engulfed in flames. Bodies and parts of bodies lay scattered around it like broken dolls.
My God,
Michaels said.
Somebody did this on purpose.
That's what it looks like. Jay is on it, but he's too busy to talk about it right now.
Michaels watched a rescue truck, lights flashing, frozen in gridlock. Jesus, they were dealing with a madman, a homicidal madman. Until he was caught, nobody was safe. Monday, September 27th, 8:41 a.m., Quantico. No real progress had been made on Steve Day's death. Alex Michaels was more than a little bothered. As head of NetForce, he suddenly found out what it meant to have the buck stop on your desk. He had to appear in front of Senator Byrd's Security Committee on Thursday to answer questions about something Day had done a year ago that had mightily upset the government. And if that wasn't enough, the political side of the job required a lot more of something else Michaels hated, socializing. Since he'd taken over, he'd gone to 4 black-tie political soirees, suffering through vulcanized chicken or salmon cooked to blackboard eraser consistency. No, this was definitely not part of the job he enjoyed. He stared at the pile of hard copy and the blinking to-do list on his computer screen. It was going to be a long day. And when it was done, he would go home to his empty condo. He missed Megan. He missed his daughter. He shook his head.
Poor you. You're just so damned sad, aren't you?
Michaels chuckled. The island of self-pity was a waste of time. He never could stay there very long. He had a job to do. He was part of the solution and not part of the problem, wasn't he? Hell with the rest of it. Monday, September 27th, 9:44 a.m., New York City.
Yes, I'll be there.
Genaloni put the phone's receiver down gently when what he wanted to do was slam it into its cradle hard enough to break both. Women. Jesus. As wives went, Maria was probably as good as any, but she always wanted most when he least had it to give. He was going to have to break a date with Brigetta, his mistress, to go to some cure-a-disease ball his wife wanted him to go to, and he wasn't happy about it. There was a tap on the door jamb. He looked up and saw Johnny the Shark, Benetti, standing in the open doorway.
Yes.
Hey, Ray, nobody we can touch has anything to say about Luigi. We put some serious money on the table, reached out to everybody who owes us favors. Nothing. He's invisible.
Keep looking.
At least one Fed was going to be sorry about this business, although there was no way to tell when the guy was going to buy it. The Selkie took his time, and it didn't do any good to try and hurry him. The intercom cheeped.
What?
It's your wife again.
Jesus. I'm not here, okay? And I forgot my cell phone, too.
Yes, sir.
Genaloni shook his head. He looked at Johnny.
A woman can cut off your nuts, cook them with onions, and make you eat them. And smile the whole time she's doing it. Remember that.
No matter what your bride says, no matter how good she is in bed, you keep your business to yourself. The prisons are full of guys who blab shit to their women and then piss them off. Women are good for a lot of things, but you don't trust one with your life. Never.
I remember that.
Good. Now go find out why the feds are hiding Luigi.
After the kid had gone, Gentiloni smiled to himself. That wasn't a bad little lecture. He'd have made an okay professor, he always figured. Tuesday, September 28th, 6:54 p.m., Washington, D.C. In her guise as Phyllis Markham, the Selkie gimped her way toward the target's house, the little poodle doing his imitation of a watering can on every other bush or tree along the way. She'd been on this more than a week, and she was ready. She knew the target's habits. When he ordered Chinese food delivered, when he went for his morning run, she knew about his ex-wife and kid in Idaho, the car he played with in his garage, and that his assistant had the hots for him, and that he didn't have a clue about that. She knew how tall he was, how much he weighed, where he got his hair cut, and that he hadn't really wanted his current job. She knew much about the target, just not why he had been chosen. That she was going to kill him didn't bother her at all. If you're going to take somebody out deliberately, you ought to get to know him, it seemed only fair. And so much better than being killed by a stranger. She knew more than enough now. He wasn't a bad guy, but he wasn't that interesting, and there wouldn't be any surprises. The gate to the target's condo opened, and the target came out, hauling a single compacted recyclable paper bag. Right on schedule. He smiled at her.
Hi. Good evening, young man.
The Selkie said in her Markham voice.
A nice night for a walk.
Yes, ma'am. The Selkie smiled. She could drop him right here with one swing of the cane. Now, should she take him inside? The moment stretched. She held the man's life in her hands. This was power. This was control. No. Not tonight. It didn't feel quite right. Maybe tomorrow. The target stood, and the woman who would soon kill him limped away.
Take care, ma'am.
Thank you, young man. I surely will. You too.
Wednesday, September 29th, 3:14 a.m., somewhere over the North Atlantic. The drone of the 747's big engines was a steady, hypnotic thrum, and most of the passengers slumped in the dark, sleeping. John Howard's reading light was on.
It wasn't much of an operation, was it, Julio?
Fernandez looked around. Nobody close to them, and the nearest were asleep. He dropped the NCO to officer rap.
Look, John, if you mean it wasn't the beach at Iwo Jima, yeah, you're right. But the assignment was find the bad guys and stop them. We did it.
Howard nodded. Fernandez was right, of course. So why didn't he feel better about it? Because it had been too easy. Yeah, Rule 6P had worked. Proper planning prevents piss-poor performance. He said as much to Fernandez. Fernandez laughed.
Thing is, John, the glory might be a bit thin on this one, but a win is a win. That's why we went, ain't it?
Yeah, you're right. Good night, Julio.
Thanks.
Sir, and if it is any consolation, I got a feeling this won't be the last episode in this particular war. Next time might be different.
Howard watched his best man amble toward a row of empty seats. Yes, there was always that. A small battle did not a war make. Wednesday, September 29th, 10:54 p.m., Portland, Oregon. Ruzio watched the front door of McCormick's restaurant. The car was a full-sized one with a large engine, though he did not think he would need the power for his escape. With both eyes open, he looked through the large aperture of the Bushnell Hollow site. What he saw was an unmagnified image of the door with a glowing red crosshair superimposed upon it. With the sighted-in rifle, Ruzio could shoot consistently into a circle made with his thumb and forefinger out to 100 meters, more than sufficient. By the time police arrived, Ruzio would be miles away. He had 3 escape routes mapped out in his mind, and all included quick stops where he would not be seen, at which he could lose the rifle. 8 minutes later, the door to the restaurant opened. 6 men emerged, talking, laughing, taking their time. Ruzio raised the rifle. He took a deep breath, let half of it out, held the rest. He clicked the safety off,
lined the glowing crosshairs up on the second man in the group, and squeezed off the shot. The man was dead before the sound of the bullet reached him. Ruzio put the rifle down on the floor of the car and started the engine. He was half a mile away at the entrance to the elevated freeway when the first police car flew past. Thursday, September 30th, 8:01 a.m., Grozny.
"You have another call, Dr. Plekhanov," Sasha said from the outer office. "Mr. Sykes from Bombay Municipal Systems."
Plekhanov smiled. The phone had certainly been busy the last couple of days, exactly as he expected it would be. After the computer foul-ups had killed hundreds of people in Bombay, those in charge would have called Bertrand, the second-rate programmer who would be unable to offer a guarantee that he could stop it from being done again. So they had called Plekhanov. Of course, he could make that assurance.
"Hello.
Vladimir, Bill Sykes, Bombay Transport."
"Ah, Bill, how are you?"
"Not so good. You heard about our problem?"
"Yes, I'm afraid so."
"Can you help us out?"
"But of course, Bill."
"Another call," Sasha yelled from her desk, "from Korea."
Plekhanov leaned back in his chair. His smile was truly a happy one. Thursday, September 30th, 8:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard met his friend Jimmy Joe in the strip club called Big Boobs. It was off-limits to boys their age, but they wore adult personas and had enough skill to pass a casual scan.
"So, Jimmy Joe, you scan anything?"
"No mucho, spider boy. Lot of strand popping on the fan, though."
Tyrone nodded. Far East Net had been DFB. Data flowing bad the last few days. The mad programmer was kicking serious ass there. The brunette stripper had left the stage. A new one came out. Well, well, look at that. Belladonna Wright herself.
"Me, I'm riding,"
Tyrone said. But he sneaked a quick look as he headed for the door. Maybe he'd take a pass at Cybernation, see what was up there. Thursday, September 30th, 8:15 a.m., Quantico. Parked in the Viper across the street, Jay Gridley watched Tyrone Howard leave the strip joint. The boy didn't see him. He smiled. The colonel had asked him to check up on his son from time to time, and Gridley didn't mind doing so, but he wouldn't mention this. No harm, no foul. Tyrone mounted his Harley and roared away. Gridley watched him leave before he started the Viper's motor. He had plenty of other stuff to worry about. Thursday, September 30th, 11:55 a.m., Quantico. Tony Fiorella stretched in the gym, warming up her knees. She looked, saw Rusty enter.
"Hey, Guru."
"Rusty, let's get started."
Her guru was right. Teaching helped sharpen your own skills. You had to think about things, get them right in your own head, before you passed them along. The ceremonial bow, something she had been doing for years, was a good example. For her, it was automatic. One long and smooth piece. But for a beginner, it was a series of small moves, and each move had a meaning.
"Do your juro, please," she said.
Rusty nodded and began juro one. It was the simplest of the dances, but from it, everything more complex arose. A metaphor for life, she had come to realize. Thursday, September 30th, 12:30 p.m., Quantico. The Selkie bought a Coke, sweet and sour chicken, and sticky rice from the Chinese place where the Target sometimes rode his trike for lunch. She wore a baggy gray T-shirt and very loose black cotton pants, a baseball cap, and dark sunglasses. The wig she affected was brunette, and even with most of it stuffed under the cap, was enough to add to her changed appearance so that she didn't look much like anybody the Target had ever seen. The Target parked the trike, pulled his gloves and helmet off, and hung them on the handlebar, then walked into the restaurant. His legs were tight, pumped from the ride. The spandex shorts hid little an interested viewer might want to look at. And it was interesting. She was not a nun, though she put sex aside when she was working. She ate the chicken. She'd had better. Had worse, too. Was today the day? She glanced at the Target where he stood in line to order. The Selkie smiled. Friday, October 1st, 7 a.m., Kiev.
Kiev had several decent restaurants, but the breakfast was catered in a private suite at the New Hilton Hotel, not far from the banks of the beautiful Dnipro. Unlike a public restaurant, such a suite could be, and had been, swept for electronic listening devices. Plekhanov wore his bland smile, revealing nothing about his thoughts. This meeting was merely one of many. Today, it was the politicians. Tomorrow, it would be the military. In a few days, he would be in another hotel room, in another country, having similar talks with politicians and generals, covering all his bets. There were three other people in the room, two men and a woman, all duly elected members of the Verkhovna Rada, the local parliament. The electronic money he had given these three access to was inconsequential, a half million or so each in the local currency. This particular money was oil for squeaky wheels, to smooth and lubricate rough spots, for bribes, gifts, political contributions, whatever it took.
"Comrade Plekhanov," the woman said.
This was Ludmila Komyakov, whose parents were originally from Moscow, and once very active in Communist Party circles.
"Igor Bulavin threatens to have his members call a strike if the new reforms are passed."
"Bulavin is a Cossack and a fool."
That was from Razin, the ex-army officer.
"He can have a fatal accident in that ancient car of which he is so proud. It can be easily arranged."
Ludmila shook her head.
"He is a threat, but perhaps killing him is not altogether necessary. Bulavin is fond of both liquor and women, but he has been discreet, careful to keep his activities in these areas confined to those which would not irritate his union members if they found out. Perhaps we could supply him a woman willing to doctor his liquor and engage in activities his members and his wife would find less than tasteful. Our woman would, of course, have an excellent holographic camera."
Plekhanov liked her solution. Brutes could be found anywhere. Subtlety was more of a prize. Well, at least he knew who the new president of the Ukraine was going to be. Thursday, September 30th, 11 p.m., Washington, D.C. In her old woman disguise, the Selkie moved toward the target's condo. She had decided to do it tonight. The target was still awake, a bit late for him, but his reading light was on, and it was going to be simple, clean, in and out. She looked around, saw she was alone. She urged her dog into the bushes to the left of the front door where he couldn't be seen.
"Scout, down. Stay."
The Selkie moved to the door and rang the bell. In bed, Alex Michaels dozed. The doorbell rang again. He frowned, still half asleep. It was probably somebody from work.
"Yeah? How come they didn't call? They have your numbers."
He opened the drawer in his bedside table, took his issued taser from the drawer, dropped it into the robe's pocket. When he looked through the peephole, he saw the old lady who had the poodle. He relaxed as he opened the door.
"I'm sorry to bother you," she said, "but Scout got off his leash. I think he wiggled through your gate into the back. If you could open it for me."
"Sure," Michaels said. "Why don't you just come on through the house to the back?"
They were in the small kitchen, almost to the sliding glass door, when Michaels heard the little dog bark. It sounded like he was out front. He turned and saw the old lady with her cane held over one shoulder like a baseball bat. Michaels tried to do two things at once. He dug for the taser in his robe's pocket and jumped backward. He didn't do either of them well, tangled his robe around one of the chairs and pulled it over. The chair fell between him and the old lady, and that's what saved his ass. He had the taser out now, and he pointed it at her. She snarled and threw the cane. It hit Michaels low, below his outstretched arm, across the belly. He didn't feel any pain, but it was hard enough to jolt his aim. She spun and ran. By the time he got to the front door, she was 20 yards away and going strong. The danger was over. He'd chased her off. Now what he needed to do was call the cops. Michaels frowned, realized he was breathing way too fast. He blew out a big sigh, tried to calm himself. What in hell was going on here? Thursday, September 30th, 11:55 p.m., Washington, D.C.
God damn it!
In her clean car, driving into the Maryland night, the Selkie's smoldering rage flared yet again. She pounded the steering wheel with the heel of her right hand. Shit, shit, shit!
Stupid. An amateur's mistake. So simple it never occurred to her. She beat on the steering wheel again. A second later, and the target would have been out cold on the floor, waiting for the final stroke. Game. Tip over your king. If the dog hadn't barked. If the target hadn't had a taser in his pocket. If that chair hadn't gotten in her way. If. Damn. Getting to the target was going to be a whole lot harder now. That brought a smile, despite her anger. Oh, yes, she was still going to delete the target. No question of that. Well, she'd wanted a challenge. She sure as hell had one now. Friday, October 1st, 12:34 a.m., Washington, D.C. Alex was trying to pretend like it was no big deal, but Tony knew better. He was rattled. Alex?
Hmm?
We'll need the dog. We'll want to run a scanner over him, see if there's an ID chip implant or anything.
No, I think he'll stay with me. Have somebody from the lab come by. They can check him here.
Alex, he's evidence.
No, he's what kept me from going to fill a hole next to Steve Days. He's a good boy, aren't you, Scout?
Tony nodded. I guess we can work on this for a while. She held up the cane, wrapped in no-smear plastic sheeting.
She wore gloves.
Won't hurt to look. He shrugged.
Well, take that stick into the lab.
I can stay around if you want.
No, go back to work. I'm all right.
She left, reluctantly, and the image of Alex standing there, petting the little dog, stayed with her as she drove back toward HQ. Friday, October 1st, 7:37 a.m., New York City. Johnny the Shark stood in front of Ray Gianoloni's desk with a sheet of paper in one hand.
This just came from our guy in the D.C. cop shop.
Gianoloni took the paper. Before he got six words into it, Johnny said,
"Seems some woman tried to kill the commander of NetForce."
Gianoloni read the paper. A woman. He couldn't believe it. He'd talked to the Selkie on the phone 3-4 times. Never had a clue. She sounded like a man. What if they caught her? The Selkie had always delivered. There was a lot of money to be made, and it wouldn't serve him, no, her, to rat him out. But now, this was bad.
We got some computer geeks on the payroll, right?
Some of the best.
Put them to work. I want them to run down the Selkie. Find her, if it really is a her.
And after we find her?
Nothing. Just find her.
Friday, October 1st, 9:12 a.m., New Orleans. Jay Gridley, downshifted from fourth to third, enjoyed the Viper's muscular rumble as it slowed for the off-ramp to the right. Welcome to New Orleans. A headline caught his attention. He waved at the vendor, held up a dollar, pointed at the paper he wanted. The headline said, "Thai Prime Minister Dies in Crash." Apparently, Prime Minister Suko had driven his car off a bridge. He'd been alone at the time. A freak accident. Gridley blew out a sigh. Well, well. The place he was going was called Algiers, and it was not the best of neighborhoods. Another turn, a right, and he was on a street barely wide enough for two cars. Ahead was the branch of the Bank of Louisiana. Parked in front of the bank branch was a shiny new metallic blue Corvette convertible with the top down, the motor running. A man came out of the bank in a hurry. He looked young, but he moved old, wore a nice suit, and he carried a briefcase in one hand. He would have passed for a customer, a businessman, except he was wearing a mask. On some level, all of a moment, Gridley knew it was him, the programmer. He was sure of it. He grinned, gunned the Viper. He'd cut the sucker off, block his escape. The driver of the Vette threw a handful of shiny dimes into the air. It wasn't until the dimes hit the street that Gridley saw they weren't coins at all, but some kind of spiked things. The left front tire went first, made a noise like a firecracker going off. The Viper lurched to the left. Then the right front tire blew. The machine spun into the new flat, lost traction as it hit the curb, popped both rear tires, and slammed into a storefront. Covered with glass and pastries, Gridley looked up at a startled baker in a white apron and hat, standing a foot away from the Viper's door.
"Hi there. Say, are your donuts, fresh?"
Friday, October 1st, 1:32 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard stood at his locker, waiting for the thumbprint reader to open the door.
"Hi, are you Tyrone?"
He turned and saw Belladonna Wright, all 14 years of her, the most beautiful girl in Eisenhower Middle School. She was smiling at him, smiling at him.
Yeah?
To his horror, and burned forever into his memory, his voice cracked.
Sarah Peterson told me you were pretty good with computers. I have to get at least an 80% in basic C or I'm in trouble. Could you maybe help me? Oh, thank you. Okay, here's my number. Call me and we can set up a time. Pross?
Oh, yes, we Pross. Bonebreaker Lamont, your heavyweight boyfriend, taking us apart like an overcooked chicken. That's what we Pross. Tyrone took the slip of paper from her, smiled reflexively, said,
Pross.
She smiled, turned, and walked away.
Tyrone, was that Bella you were talking to?
Tyrone stared at Jimmy Joe.
She just stopped to ask me something, to help her with her basic C stuff. Somewhere private, like, say, her place? Oh, man. Oh, no. Oh, yeah. Here's how I scenario it. Bonebreaker drops by, sees you leaning over Bella's tasty shoulder with your hand on her mouse, and it's sayonara, Tyrone San. I think I need to go to the bathroom,
Tyrone said. Suddenly, he needed to do that real bad. Friday, October 1st, 7:30 p.m., Grozny. VR gear removed. Plekhanov sat in his chair, breathing hard. How had that American Net Force operative gotten so close, so fast? Yes, he had stopped him, wrecked his program, but that had been too near a miss. Still, he would exercise even more caution. The perfect crime was not in getting away once you'd been spotted. The perfect crime was one nobody ever knew had been committed. Meanwhile, the trips to Belarus and Kyrgyzstan were next on the agenda. He would continue to sow. Soon, he would reap. Friday, October 1st, 4:02 p.m., Quantico. Michael's boss, the director of the FBI, was online, and what he had to convey was not happy news.
The president is concerned, Alex. It's been more than 3 weeks.
I understand, Michael said.
We need a victory,
Walt Carver continued.
Sooner you come up with something, the better. And when I say sooner, I'm talking about a couple of days.
After Carver disconnected, Michaels stood. He needed to move, to burn off some of this nervous tension. Hell, he could get another job. That wasn't the problem. As long as he got Steve Day's killer before they threw him out, he could live with it. He hadn't wanted to sit in the damn chair in the first place, not given the cost. He was too nervous to sit still. Maybe he should go to the gym and work up a sweat. Being stuck as an administrator, he had discovered, wasn't much fun. Friday, October 1st, 4:42 p.m., Quantico. Jay Gridley walked into the VR Cane Masters store in Incline Village, Nevada. Given his choice, he would rather be hunting the robber in New Orleans, but somebody had tried to kill his boss last night, and that took precedence. An attractive Chinese woman clerk, behind the counter, smiled at Jay. Help you?
You keep records of your sales?
Of course.
Is there any way to find out who bought this?
I'm afraid our client records are confidential, sir.
You have a manager I could talk to?
Just a moment.
A tall man, wearing a frown, appeared behind the clerk in a few seconds.
May I help you, sir?
Gridley produced his NetForce ID and held it out.
I need your sales records. You can voluntarily give them to me, or I can get a federal subpoena and be back in an hour with a gang of IRS CPA programmers to deconstruct everything your company has done in the last 10 years.
We're happy to help the government in any way we can.
Outside the store, Gridley walked to his new Viper. In the car, he looked at the HC printout. In the last 10 years, Cane Masters had sold several hundred of the particular model NetForce was interested in. Still, running down several hundred possibilities was better than running down no possibilities. Friday, October 1st, 11:14 p.m., Las Vegas. Grigory the Snake had won 300 in chips, playing at the $5 blackjack tables at the big pyramid-shaped casino. To celebrate, he was getting drunk and talking about looking for a prostitute. Ruzio did not know how prevalent HIV was among American trolls. In parts of Africa and Southeast Asia, 8 of 10 whores would be infected. The snake could catch something, rot slowly and painfully, and it was all the same to Ruzio. He did feel sorry for Grigory's wife, who might also contract the disease before her husband had the grace to die. He did not know why he had gone along with the snake for this outing. Ruzio was not a gambler. Perhaps he was trying to prove to himself that he could still relax and have a good time. But the days when Ruzio could party all night and then work the next day without sleeping were long past. Winters came to stand next to him. The American wore a black T-shirt with the logo of another casino, one shaped like a lion, upon the back. "Our boy racking up a few bucks?"
"He is ahead, yes. 3 more hands, and he plans to leave to seek professional female company."
"Now there's an idea. Might as well blow your money on blowjobs." Ruzio looked at Winters, then back at the snake.
"I'm going back to my room."
Outside, it was cool, even after a day when the afternoon temperature had been near body heat. And what was he going to do when this assignment was over? Where would he go? He would accept another assignment from Plekhanov, and he would do it. And he would keep on doing them, until one day he came up against a younger, faster, hungrier opponent. And then it would be over. Aside from Anna, it was all he had ever had. It was his path, and he would follow it until it ended. The dry wind followed him as he walked toward his hotel. Saturday, October 2nd, noon, Quantico. Tony bent over, touched her toes, then dropped into a deep squat. She looked up and saw Rusty come out of the men's locker room.
"Rusty, I didn't think you'd be here today."
"Well, I knew you'd be working, and I didn't have anything else on my schedule. I mean, if it's okay."
"Sure."
He faced her. They bowed in, and she started him on the first judo. As Rusty went back and forth, repeating the simple block-elbow-punch combination, Tony corrected his form, demonstrated the footwork, adjusted slightly the positions of his hands. She had always had to do a motion dozens or hundreds of times before it sank in, but Rusty was a quick student. He picked up the lessons pretty fast. After 10 minutes of judo practice, Tony stopped him.
"Okay, today we're going to work on sapu and biset moves. The first technique I'll show you is called biset luar."
"Sounds like something I should be writing down."
"Don't worry about it. You'll hear it again."
"Okay.
Here's the block from the outside. I put my hip against yours, and I cork it inward, just like the juru stance, you see? Shoulders and hips square."
"Yeah."
"This is my base."
"Geometry."
"Absolutely. So then I use my right hand up here on your neck. Elbow down. This is my leverage. So now I've got all three. Base, angle, and leverage. What happens?"
"I go down."
She applied a little pressure, tugged with her foot, and Rusty dropped flat onto his back. He came up. "One more time," she said. "You feel my hip, how it's pressed in there?"
"Oh, yes, ma'am. I surely do feel that."
She dropped him again. She caught the not-so-veiled sexual tone in his voice. She grinned. If he liked that, wait until she stepped inside and showed him the dalam. Saturday, October 2nd, 12:18 p.m., Quantico. Alex Michaels prowled the hall, too wired to eat. He knew Tony usually worked out at noon, and it gave him a place to go, so Michaels headed toward the gym. When he got there, he saw Tony and the big FBI trainee. For some reason, he felt a stab of irritation. Come on. Tony was his second in command, that was all. They didn't have any romantic notions about each other. "Alex."
Sorry, I was just passing by, on my way to the cafeteria."
He turned and walked away. Tony's personal life was her own, period, end of story. He had enough to worry about on his own, thank you. Saturday, October 2nd, 1 p.m., Miami Beach. In the Miami identity, she had established that she was a recreational runner. Today, when Maura Sullivan came in from her noon run, she found her computer flashing its warning light signal. The house alarm diodes were all green. Nobody had come into the building itself. The computer warning was due to an electronic break-in, or somebody trying to. She stripped off, sat naked on the office chair, and said, "Security program log on." The Vox Axe brought the log up on screen.
She scanned the program. Somebody had probed at the Selkie's comm circuit. She hoped they weren't good enough to spot the leeches she'd left for potential invaders. Security, backtrack the intruder. A series of numbers and letters flashed on the screen, followed by a map. When it reached New York City, the dot representing the intruder pulsed, and an electronic address lit. A name flashed. Ruark Electronic Services, Incorporated.
Security, give me the names and any holding companies for Ruark.
Well, well, well. The owner of 75% of the outstanding shares was something called Electronic Enterprises Group, which itself just happened to be a wholly owned subsidiary of Genelone Industries. Sullivan leaned back and stared at the screen. So, Genelone was trying to find her. This was not altogether unexpected. Genelone was a thug, but he was a smart thug, and a persistent one. If he was worried that the Selkie might be linked to him, he would do everything he could to remove the link. She wouldn't be collecting any more money for the target she had missed, but that was not really important. For her own pride, she would finish that job, payment or not. She would have to do something about Genelone, too. Saturday, October 2nd, 1:15 p.m., Washington, D.C.
Tyrone, this is Bella. Did you lose my number? No, I was just about to call you.
That's good, said the voice of self-preservation, hiding behind its rock.
Tell her you have a fatal disease and you can't leave the house. So, can you come over this afternoon?
No, no, a million quadrillion times no.
Sure, I can do that. About three, okay? Sure, three. This means a lot to me, you know? Sure, no pra. Discom.
Yeah, no pra and discom, deadhead. Bonebreaker will make it quick. Just snap your neck fast so you won't suffer too much. Asshole, fool, moron. His mother wandered into the room.
Hey, hon, who was that on the phone? A person from school. I'm going to go over to their house at three. Is that okay? A person? They? Them?
His mom grinned.
Would this person perhaps be of the female persuasion, Ty? Aw, jeez, Mom. That's what I thought. Do you need a ride? I'll take the trans. Lighten up, Ty. I know I used to ride dinosaurs to school, but my memory hasn't all gone. It's not as dangerous as you think, talking to a girl.
She laughed.
So much for what you know, said the voice from behind its rock.
Saturday, October 2nd, 1:33 p.m., Quantico. Jay Gridley waved the presentation projector on.
Good news and bad news. The cane came from this store. After eliminating a whole bunch of customers, we're left with eight possibilities. Of the eight, our agents have so far interviewed five. Of the three remaining subjects, one is a survivalist in Oregon who refuses to allow local, state, or federal agents on his property. The gentleman in question is 70 years old, so that's pending. The remaining two names are interesting. Wilson A. Jefferson of Erie, Pennsylvania. Mr. Jefferson, in the last 3 years, has bought a cane, two sets of Eskrima sticks, and a set of custom-designed Yawara sticks. Mr. Jefferson is a white male, 41 years old, and he resides at this address.
A street number and name blossomed.
However, a check at this address came up negative. What we have here is an electronic man. Then, there's Mr. Richard Orlando. Mr. Orlando has bought, over a period of 4 years, five canes, including two of the model we have in hand. All were delivered to a post office box in Austin, Texas. A check says he is an Hispanic male, 27 years old, and as far as we can tell, also exists only in a few record computers.
Same person, using two fake IDs, Michael said.
That's the good news. There are no trails leading away. As far as we can tell, the only reason these two E-men ever existed was to take delivery of some fancy but perfectly legal sticks.
Dead end, Tony said.
Deader than black plastic in the noonday sun. We're running checks on all known professional assassins. So far, nothing substantial on anybody as good as this one seems to be.
Michaels nodded.
Anybody got anything else?
Brent Adams, the FBI head of organized crime, said,
something is going on inside the Genelone organization.
couple of weeks ago, the FBI regional office in New York City got an inquiry from one of Gentiloni's lawyers regarding the detention of Luigi Sampson. Well, our agents in New York didn't detain Sampson, but since then, our wiretaps and surveillance cams haven't heard or seen anything of him.
Maybe he went on vacation, Jay said.
Adams shrugged. Maybe. Or maybe he pissed off Ray Gentiloni and he's in a field pushing up the daisies. Michaels said,
so why would Gentiloni's people be calling the FBI, supposedly looking for Sampson, if they deleted him?
Adams shook his head again. Establish an alibi, maybe. Michaels sighed.
All right, if you'd stay on top of that, Brent. Jay, you run the Kane stuff as far as you can. Anything else?
Nobody had anything they wanted to put on the table.
Okay, let's get back to it.
Saturday, October 2nd, 11:25 p.m., Grozny. He would have preferred a walk on his quiet trail, but because he was in a hurry, Plekhanov drove the car. This was just a short run to make a few minor adjustments on a legal scenario running in Canberra. The chances of Netforce seeing him were practically nil, and besides, there were a lot of blue Corvettes out there, probably tens of thousands of them. He put the VR automobile into gear and pressed on the accelerator. Saturday, October 2nd, 3:05 p.m., Washington, D.C. When Belladonna Wright opened the door to let him in, the first thing Tyrone noticed was that she wore tight shorts and a baggy sweatshirt with the sleeves and neck cut out to reveal a lot of bare skin. The second thing was the hulking form of Bonebreaker Lamotte sitting on a couch.
Oh, wow. Hey, Tyrone. Glad to meet you. It's real nice of you to help Bella out with her computer class. If I can ever do anything for you, just let me know, okay? Okay, Bella. I'll call you later.
Still marveling over being alive, Tyrone followed Bella to her room. She had a standard home computer, and the VR gear was not top of the line, but pretty decent. She said,
I'm okay on theory and real time, but my network is slow.
You came to the right guy, then. You have another set of VR gear?
Right here.
Gear up. Let's walk the web.
You're in charge, Tyrone.
Flushed with a sudden fearlessness, he took a leap.
Call me Ty.
Sunday, October 3rd, 6 a.m., Sarajevo. Small arms fire rattled. Bullets chopped bark from trees, dug furrows in the ground. They were in a city park, and the attack had been unexpected. John Howard opened up with his Tommy gun.
Sir, we've got...
The lieutenant went down, a stray round in the neck. Where were they coming from? His men began falling. Their armor wasn't working. They were getting their butts kicked. Washington, D.C. John Howard jerked the VR gear off and dropped it in disgust. He shook his head. Oh, crap. He was, he realized, depressed. Oh, not clinically depressed. Nothing to run to a shrink about, but definitely glum. He didn't understand it. There wasn't any reason to feel that way.
Morning.
Howard looked up, saw Tyrone standing there in his pajama bottoms.
Just after 0600, Howard said. What are you doing up so early?
I woke up, couldn't get back to sleep. Can I ask you something, Pop?
Fire away.
How do you deal with a force that's bigger and stronger than yours if it already holds territory you want to occupy?
When did you get interested in such things?
Oh, it's what you do. I thought I ought to, you know, kind of check it out.
Okay. Your goal is to take the territory without destroying it, am I correct?
Oh, yeah.
So, you have to move carefully. You look for your enemy's weak points. In guerrilla warfare, you find a weak place, you hit it, then run.
Tyrone leaned against the fridge.
Yeah, I can see that.
Also, according to Chairman Mao, you have to get the locals on your side. Then it doesn't matter how strong your enemy is, because the locals will start to help you, to hide you from enemy forces. Sometimes they'll overthrow your enemy on their own. In the end, that's the best way.
There was a moment of silence. Then Tyrone said,
Thanks, Pop. I'm going back to bed now.
Sleep well, son.
After the boy was gone, Howard grinned at his milk. It had been a long time since he'd been that young. He tasted the milk, warm. He walked to the sink, poured the milk into it, rinsed the glass, set it to dry on the rack.
Maybe he could go back to sleep, too. Might as well give it a shot.
Sunday, October 3rd, 6:40 a.m., Washington, D.C. Alex Michaels stood by the sliding glass door and watched the dog wander around in the backyard. He'd shut the system's sliding door link off to let the dog out, but he had his taser in his robe pocket. There was a car parked at his curb with a pair of agents in it. A third guard stood by the gate on the side of the condo. Michaels wouldn't have known about the third guard, except that the dog had seen the man and yapped at him until he'd been hushed. Better than the house alarm, the little pup. Michaels liked dogs. He hadn't gotten one after he'd moved to D.C. because he hadn't wanted to leave it alone while he was at work. But as little as Scout was, the house was plenty big enough to roam around in. Well, time to get moving. Better shower and shave and get dressed. He had a thought. Why not take the dog with him to work? He could let him run around the office, take him out to pee once in a while. He was the boss, wasn't he? At least for another day or two he was. Sure. Why the hell not? Sunday, October 3rd, 6:40 a.m., Quantico. John Howard wore an army green T-shirt and faded, frayed cargo pocket fatigue pants over his Kevlar combat boots. He also wore a black headband. He sweated pretty good once he got going, and keeping a garrison cap on was hopeless. But otherwise, he looked like any of the other 50 troopers doing the obstacle course this early Sunday morning. Fernandez blew his whistle. "Go! Go!" Howard sprinted toward the water hazard, jumped, caught the thick rope, and swung out over the pit, more mud than water. Clear. Ahead was a 15-foot-high wall with a rope draped over it. If you got there at speed and jumped high as you caught the climbing line, you could make it over with two or three pulls, roll, and hit the sawdust pit in 3 seconds. The next obstacle was essentially a 40-foot-long telephone pole lying in a series of 6-foot-high, X-shaped 4x4 supports. At the other end, there was another sawdust pit, only the dust was not wood, but reconstituted buckyball plastic. The colonel reached the end of the pole walk, jumped outward, laid back, and hit, flat on his back, hands extended, palms down. He was making good time. Not his best, but not bad, he felt. The minefield was a 20-foot-wide corridor of sand, 30 yards long. The mines were electronic, about the size of a softball, and not dangerous, but if you stepped on one, you knew it. It let out an amplified scream that would wake a man 6 days dead. 40 seconds later, he was clear, without triggering a sonic blast, and feeling pretty good. The last test this day was Sergeant Arlo Phillips, a 6-foot-4-inch, 240-pound hand-to-hand combat instructor. Phillips's role was simple. You tried to get past him to slap a buzzer button, mounted on a post in the middle of a white circle. When Howard's turn came, he went straight in at Phillips, jinked left, then right, faked high, then dived to the left and rolled. Phillips got his hand on Howard's right ankle as he came up, but too late. The colonel swatted at the buzzer, barely brushed it with his fingertips, as Phillips jerked him prone on the ground.
You got officer's luck, sir.
I'll take it. Better to be lucky than good.
Howard walked toward the new officer's dressing room. Hell, it was all new. None of this had even been here a few years ago, to change his clothes. If he hurried, he'd just have time to get home and join his wife in time for church. Sunday, October 3rd, 7:45 a.m., in the air over Marietta, Georgia. Maura Sullivan looked through the jet's window at the ground far below. During all her years in the biz, she had only deleted two of her own clients. The first, Marcel Tullier, had been for a contract from a different client 6 months after she'd worked for the Frenchman. Being one of her clients did not confer immunity. The second deletion, the gun dealer, Denton Harrison, had been because Harrison had done stupid things and gotten himself arrested. Sooner or later, Harrison might have gotten around to mentioning that he had hired the Selkie. Wearing Class 2 body armor, on his way to a safe house, Harrison had come out of a courthouse in Chicago surrounded by federal marshals. She had made the shot from 600 yards. He was effectively dead before the sound of the shot reached him. And now, there was Jenna Loney. Did she have to take the crime lord out? If she had reflexively thought she must, she would hardly be any better than he was. Yes, she had to do something. But which was the best way to go? Sunday, October 3rd, 1:28 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone stood at the door to Bella's house, taking deep breaths, trying to calm himself. He touched the buzzer. Bella opened the door. Today she wore a less revealing outfit, a sweatsuit.
"Hey, Ty, I just got out of the shower."
There was an image he could imagine all too clearly. Bella in the shower.
"Come in."
Upstairs, they donned VR gear and got started. He said,
"Okay, let's use my program today. You mind riding double on a big motorcycle?" "No problem."
Sunday, October 3rd, 9:45 p.m. Grozny. Plekhanov settled in, lit his VR, then realized he still had not deleted the car program. The shiny blue Corvette sat parked at the curb in front of him. All right. As soon as he finished the little drive over to Switzerland, he would dump it. Definitely. Sunday, October 3rd, 1:50 p.m., Washington, D.C. Riding the Harley along the curvy road through the Swiss Alps, Tyrone yelled over the wind noise,
"You see how this works? That truck over there? If we were in a water scenario, it would probably be a barge or a ship. So this is all off-the-shelf software? Well, I've modified this one a bunch. Could you show me how to do that?" "Yeah, sure, no problem."
In that moment, Tyrone remembered talking to his father.
"Offer the locals something they can't get from your enemy."
The old man was right. Tyrone had something Bonebreaker Lamotte didn't have. A skill, a talent. And right at this moment, Bella wanted it. This was DFF for sure. Data flowing fine to the fourth power. Tyrone tapped the Harley's gears into first and gave it a little gas.
"You see that blue vet up there?"
"Yeah."
"I need to check it out. I'm helping out a buddy of mine at NetForce."
"Wow, exemplary, Ty."
Was that his imagination, or did she tighten her grip around his waist a little?
"Can we catch him?"
"No problem. There's not much that can outrun me in this scenario. Hang on."
Definitely, she was holding him tighter.
Yes.
Sunday, October 3rd, 9:58 p.m., Grozny. Plekhanov was on his way back from the bank in Zurich when he saw the motorcycle coming up fast behind him. After a few seconds, the motorcycle passed, cut back into his lane, and accelerated, missing the oncoming lorry by what seemed like centimeters. The two-wheeler quickly left him behind. Plekhanov shook his head at his paranoia. It was nothing. A Kaffir boy, showing off for his pretty friend by blowing past the fastest vehicle on the road, risking the dangers of oncoming traffic. Teenagers thought they would live forever, that they could do anything in the world. He knew better. Another 50 or 60 years, and his time would be up. But at least, in his case, it would be quality time. Quality time indeed.
Sunday, October 3rd, 2:20 p.m., Washington, D.C. Jay Gridley was on the net, piloting the Viper at high speed through the middle of nowhere, Montana, when the override cut into the scenario.
"Yeah?"
"Mr. Gridley?"
"Who is this?"
"My name is Belladonna Wright. I'm a friend of Ty Howard. He thinks he might have found the blue Corvette you're looking for."
"Jesus. Where?"
She rattled off the coordinates.
"Thanks, Ms. Wright. Tell him I'm on the way. Discom."
Gridley called up the gray neon. The most common car on the RW roads was a 2-year-old neon, and the most common color of such automobiles was gray. If this was the guy, he most definitely did not want to be spotted too soon. He cranked the program and set it for the coordinates. They turned out to be a truck stop-style service station in western Germany. Gridley glanced at the restaurant, saw the vet parked next to the building. He killed the engine, stepped out of the car.
"Hey, Tyrone."
"Hey, J.G. This is Belladonna. We spoke on the phone. Nice to meet you. There's the car. The driver's inside."
Gridley nodded.
"Thanks for the call. You check the license plate?"
"Sure, first thing. Quickscan says it belongs to a Wing Lu out of Guangzhou, China. But a cross-index number check doesn't match."
"So what else?"
"He drives fast, changes lanes without hitting the centerline bumps, never gets caught behind a slow packet or boxed by traffic."
"A lubefoot."
"No doubt."
"What's a lubefoot?"
the girl asked.
Somebody who slides along the web without much friction, Tyrone answered. Which means? Probably he's a programmer.
All right. You want to stay on it? You ride with me. Leave the bike here. We'll see how long we can run with him.
Gridley walked to the car, the two teenagers behind him. He had a sudden thought.
Better get in the back, he said. I've got stuff piled up all over the front passenger seat.
They had just entered the car when Tyrone said,
There he is.
Gridley looked. Yes, it was the same persona he'd seen in New Orleans. He reached under the Neon's dashboard and came out with a comm mic. In the back, Tyrone quietly told the girl,
He's alerting law enforcement agencies. Any cop on the net who sees the Corvette will log in a time and location. We might be able to get a location pattern after we lose him. You don't think we can keep up with him? Not if the guy's a lubefoot running guilty. He'll spot a tail sooner or later, so he has to outrun us or lose us some other way.
Gridley cranked the Neon's engine.
Yeah, well, that's later.
He looked at the vet as it pulled out of the lot and onto the highway.
Until then, he's not gone until he's gone. Buckle up.
Sunday, October 3rd, 3 p.m., Albany, New York. As a matter of course, Sullivan paid for the lost dog. So now she was in Albany, and now she had made her decision. She was a young woman. She might have another 60 or 80 years, given the state of medicine, maybe more. It was time to leave the party. But the one big dangling problem was Genaloni. He had to become part of her past, her dead past. It wouldn't even be that hard. Genaloni had a small army of thugs and lawyers, but he also had a mistress. Her name was Brigetta, and while she was well off from Genaloni's care, she had neither lawyers nor bodyguards between her and the world. So, first Genaloni, then the bureaucrat in Washington, then off for a month in beautiful Hawaii, maybe. Or perhaps Tahiti, someplace warm and sunny, and without clocks or work to order her day. The Selkie smiled. It was good to have a new goal. Sunday, October 3rd, 11:05 p.m., the North Euro-Asian Highway. He had, Plekhanov realized, a tail. The car shadowing him was one of those ubiquitous little sedan things, like millions of others on the net. Who was it? How had they found him? He swung the Corvette back onto the main road. Best to pretend he did not see them. Better the devil one knew than the devil one did not. The gray car followed, maintaining a fairly long distance, but assuring him he was right. They would be gathering information generated from his vehicle. Vectors, construction, code modules, all things that, in the hands of an expert, could eventually point to him. If they stayed with him long enough, they would suck his true identity out. Or get so close, they'd find him on a first or second pass through their strainers. All right. He could park the car, go into a restaurant, bail from the scenario. No, what was he thinking? That kind of panicky reflex would leave them the car and a possible way to trace it. Something else. Maybe he could lose the chase car, take a side road, maybe duck other pursuit, get away from this scenario and dump it. Certainly worth a try. When he was ready, he drew the spikes from the pouch he carried, and with a quick and practiced hand, scattered them across all four lanes behind him. The pursuers swerved, missed most of the caltrops, but still ran over a few. But the gray car's tires did not deflate, nor did it slow. If anything, it speeded up. Damn, damn. They must suspect who he was, at least in this persona and vehicle. He had to get out of VR now. Plekhanov de-geared and slapped at the power switch, killed the juice to his computer, didn't bother with the emergency shutdown procedures. Sunday, October 3rd, 3:05 p.m., Washington, D.C. Ahead of them, the Corvette exploded into a bright flash of light, then vanished. There he goes, Tyrone said to Bella. He spotted us and crashed out. To J.G., he said, You get anything useful?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. He was on the road to Central Asia. Russia. One of the CIS, maybe. He might have turned off at the India Road up ahead, or been going on through to the Orient. But if he was planning to head south, he should have cut that way 100 clicks back. I think he was going home. And I think he drives like a Russian. We're going to have to take what we've got home and study it. Maybe we got enough to nail this sucker.
Sunday, October 3rd, 3:23 p.m., Quantico. Michaels waved his phone circuit to life.
Yes.
Boss, Jay Gridley. I'm in my car on the way to the office. We got something on the guy who's been giving us fits in Europe and Asia.
Michaels felt a quick stab of disappointment. Steve Day was higher up his personal priority list right at the moment. Still, the other business was more important for NetForce, even if his career did go down in flames.
Well, that's great, Jay. I'll be there in about 15 minutes.
Sunday, October 3rd, 4 p.m., Long Island. Ray Genaloni glanced at his watch. Traffic, even this far out on Long Island on a damn Sunday, was terrible. It pissed him off. Every minute he spent stuck in a crawl of cars and trucks was one more he wouldn't get to spend with Brigetta. When he got to her place, a little house he'd bought for her on a cul-de-sac in a quiet neighborhood, Genaloni sat in his car until his guards did a quick check of the area. He rang the bell, and his mistress opened the door. Her grandparents had come from Sweden or Denmark or somewhere like that, and she was big, busty, and fit. You could also see she was a natural blonde.
"Hi, handsome. My husband is out. Want to come in and have a drink?"
He smiled. Sometimes they played games. He knew she was giving his bodyguards a show, and he liked that.
"Suffer, boys,"
he thought. Sunday, October 3rd, 2:01 p.m., Las Vegas. Ruzio watched as the snake fed a dollar bill into one of the slot machines and waited expectantly. He was not a winner.
"Don't know when to quit, does he?"
Winters said.
"A heavy call to make," Ruzio said. "Let him spend whatever he wants until the plane leaves. We have more than an hour."
He moved to a bank of public telephones, clamped a one-time scrambler over the mouthpiece, and dialed the emergency number. Plekhanov's voice was terse.
"That engineering matter you began has not been completed to my satisfaction."
Ruzio knew they were speaking of the action to divert NetForce's attention, the assassination of its leader, the dragon's teeth, sown to put that organization at war with the criminal group.
"It is early yet."
"Nonetheless, we need to bring that matter along. An attempt was made to duplicate your first experiment by someone in the employ of the Italian company. They were unable to match your end results."
"And you want me to take care of that?"
"Very likely. It would perhaps be prudent to locate yourself close to that area."
"Of course."
"Goodbye, then. I will speak to you tomorrow."
Ruzio removed the one-time scrambler and stared at it. The visual purple biomolecular matrix that was the brain of the device would begin dying the moment the pressure switch left the phone's mouthpiece. In 20 seconds, the device's memory would be blank, the circuitry dead. He stood there, holding the scrambler for a full minute, then dropped it into the trash. So, they would be going to Washington again. Grigory wandered over, away from the row of slot machines.
"Are you done gambling?"
"Da."
Ruzio could not resist a small verbal jab. A needle, just enough to sting. He said,
"Your system apparently needs some refinement."
The snake frowned. Ruzio took a certain amount of pleasure in the expression. Sunday, October 3rd, 6:15 p.m., Quantico. Tony Fiorella stepped out of the NetForce HQ into the cool evening air and headed for her car. The parking lot was nearly empty, but angling toward her, carrying a briefcase, was a figure she recognized.
"Rusty, what's up?"
"I've been doing some research on CLAT. I'd like to get your opinion on it."
He waggled the briefcase.
"I could show it to you at supper."
"Are you asking me out?"
"Oh, yes, ma'am, I guess I am."
"So, what is it to be, Tony?"
"Jesus, girl, if you wait for Alex to notice you as a woman, you might die of old age before it happens. Besides, it's just supper. He didn't ask you to bear his children or anything."
"All right, I suppose we can have something to eat."
Despite herself, Tony felt a little surge of adrenaline. Outside of work, it had been a long time since she'd been out with a man socially, and dinner wouldn't hurt anybody. Sunday, October 3rd, 7:44 p.m., Washington, D.C. Alex took Scout for a walk in his neighborhood. This was much against the wishes of his new security team, 14 agents in all, the chief bodyguard told him. It seemed like a spendy use of the taxpayers' money to have that many people guarding him, but his boss had signed the order personally. Caution, fear, was a new feeling for him. He was a fair-sized man, in pretty good shape, living in the hub of civilization. The last time he had been in a fight had been in the seventh grade. Michaels smiled at the memory of his boyhood fistfight. He'd been what? All of 13. A long time ago. But the smile faded at the more recent memory of Scout's former owner and the look on her face as she prepared to brain him with her cane. He could have died. Whack! A cracked skull, just like that, and he'd never have woken up. Ever. He hadn't been afraid during the actual fight, but afterward, he had been afraid. He'd felt helpless. He hated it, that sick feeling of helplessness. Yeah, he had chased the would-be killer. He hadn't run away or anything, but even though he had done the right thing, he hadn't felt brave. He realized he didn't have the skill he needed. Maybe he should talk to Tony. She was an expert. He had seen that for himself. Maybe she would teach him some of what she knew. Yes, the idea of being able to take a stick away from somebody and keep himself in one piece while he did it had a great appeal to Alex Michaels just now. Sunday, October 3rd, 8:09 p.m., Washington, D.C. It had been a long and exciting day for Tyrone. First there was Bella, then the business helping J.G. with the mad programmer in the Corvette. At the door, Bella said,
"Thanks for the help, Ty."
She leaned over and kissed him on the lips. When he got partial control back, he managed a stammer.
What about Lamont? He doesn't own me. We aren't married.
She smiled.
See ya.
She closed the door. His feet must have been on the ground as he walked towards the trans station, but Tyrone could hardly tell. So this was what it was like to be in love. Sunday, October 3rd, 10:01 p.m., Washington, D.C. In her apartment, Tony looked at the black plastic tape box Rusty handed her.
"Where did you get this?"
"I found it on a web page for a bookstore in Alabama a couple of days ago. I don't have a VHS player, so I haven't had a chance to see it yet."
On the front of the box, part of the faded illustration had been torn off, but the title, Pokolan Penchak Silat, The Devastating Fighting Art of Bukti Negara Serak, Volume 3, was still readable. She felt a quick rush of excitement. She hadn't known anybody had made tapes of her art. She moved to the multimedia player, pushed the tape into the VHS slot. The machine lit. She clicked on the television, went back to sit on the couch next to Rusty.
"I bought it for you," he said. "I figured you'd appreciate it more than I would."
She smiled.
"Thank you."
She put her hand on his arm. The moment stretched. The gesture was a simple touch, nothing more, and it meant nothing more than a slight emphasis to her thanks, unless she left her hand there. The moment continued. Tony decided. She did not pull her hand away. Monday, October 4th, 5:05 a.m., Washington, D.C. Suddenly aware of how stiff and tired he felt, Jay Gridley looked at the clock. He'd been up all night. He had scanned enough material to fill a tanker, but now he had a better sense of the programmer they'd chased. Currently, the computer was going through all registered programmers living in Russia. They were going to get this lubefoot. It was just a matter of time. The priority incoming email chime sounded. One of the field teams had something on the day assassination. Gridley downloaded the attached file and opened it. It didn't take long for him to see the meat of the message.
"Well, well, look at that."
Monday, October 4th, 5:05 a.m., Washington, D.C. Megan Michaels was on the front porch of their house, holding hands with a dark-haired, burly man. The two of them kissed. The man slid his hands down her back, cupped her buttocks. She moaned softly, then turned and saw Alex standing there. She smiled at him.
"I'm his now," she said. "Not yours."
Michaels came out of the nightmare, thick with jealousy and anger. He got up, shuffled toward the bathroom. Scout stood, stretched himself like a cat, hopped off the bed, and came to stand next to Michaels. The dog sat, then watched intently as the stream of urine splashed into the toilet bowl. What was Scout thinking? That this was a bit of territory the man was marking as his own?
Yep, this is my toilet, all right, Michael said. Mine, mine, mine.
Monday, October 4th, 5:05 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tony lay in her bed, staring at the ceiling. Naked next to her under the covers, Jesse Rusty Russell slumbered on, breathing heavy. Oh, Lord, why had she done this? She had certainly enjoyed the taste and feel of him, and it had been quite an athletic and satisfying romp. And yet, it still wasn't right. Why did she feel so guilty? What was she doing here with this stranger in her bed? It should be Alex lying there, sated, happy, in love with her. She liked Rusty, but she didn't love him. It had been enjoyable, but it had also been a mistake, and she was not going to repeat it. Monday, October 4th, 5:05 a.m., Columbia, Maryland. Ruzio sat cross-legged on the motel bed, staring at nothing. Plekhanov would eventually call. Today, tomorrow, the day after. Likely when he did call, the Russian would order Ruzio to go forth and kill again. Part of Plekhanov's grand plan to become a powerful man who could run countries as he chose. Ruzio was the tool that did the deed. It was his only reason for staying alive. Live, die. It was all the same. Monday, October 4th, 7:30 a.m., Quantico. Jay was waiting when Michaels arrived at his office. He was smiling.
You have good news?
Oh, yeah.
Come in.
Jay lit the system, called up a file.
This is the Not the Brothers dog kennel. They'll train your dog, sell you one already educated, or even rent you one. That's what happened with yours. He's a rental. This woman is really sharp, boss. Cash and instructions came by courier. Our ops traced the dog's delivery to another courier, and then a third delivery service, which wound up giving it to somebody waiting in the lobby of a new Holiday Inn in North Schenectady.
That doesn't sound too promising to me.
Have a wait. The Holiday Inn have surveillance cams built in all over the place. Take a look at this.
Jay touched more controls. Here's the guy who picked up the dog, and here is the woman he gave it to. She looked about 40, had graying, brown hair worn long, was a little dumpy, sported sunglasses, baggy pants, and running shoes. Angela anybody.
She doesn't look anything like the old lady. So how does this help us?
Well, computer-enhanced imagery says she probably didn't alter the shape of her ears or her hands. And using objects that we know the measurements of, we can tell her shoe size, her height. We can come pretty close on her true weight if we extrapolate from wrists and neck diameter. There's a little more. Watch. See how the floor is wet? They had just mopped the exit way there.
The next image showed the woman lurch to the left, put out her arm, stop herself with her free hand against the wall at shoulder height. Michaels made the connection. He looked at Jay.
Prints.
A clean index, middle, and ring, and a smudged pinky. Oh, and did I mention we got a few cells and a little usable DNA?
Jesus, why didn't you say so to begin with?
That's not how you tell a story, boss.
Michaels was elated, but he tried not to let it overwhelm him.
What about the other thing, the programmer?
Getting close to him. He's a Russian, Ukrainian, something like that. I got baby Huey checking profiles.
I thought you said he could mask his profile.
Only partially. I'll know him when I see him. Style is what gives it away. He's too good to hide all his talent. Some of it will seep out of any bushel he buries it under.
After Jay left, Michaels called up the material and scanned it again, ordering it in his mind. When he was comfortable with it, he reached for his comm to put in a call to Walt Carver. As he waited, Michaels looked up and saw Tony pass by his window. He'd call her in and let her know what Jay had found as soon as he was done telling the director. She'd be happy to hear the news.
Good morning, Alex. You have good news for me?
Yes, sir, I believe so. Very good news.
Wednesday, October 6th, 9:11 a.m., Long Island. The Selkie stood on the doorstep, holding a small box wrapped in expensive paper. She rang the bell. A minute passed. The Selkie rang the bell again.
What?
Came a sleepy voice from the intercom.
I have a delivery from Steinberg's Jewelers for a Ms. Brigitte Olsen.
A delivery?
Jesus, honey. Which part of that didn't you understand?
from a Mr. Genaloni?
Hold on a sec.
The woman inside opened the door only as far as the chain latch would allow.
I'll need you to sign for it, ma'am,
the sulky said. She waved the clipboard. Brigetta hesitated. The sulky could probably boot the door and pop the safety chain loose, or she could pull the small 22 caliber pistol she had tucked into the inside the waistband holster. But that was risky, and she definitely didn't want the woman dead.
Oh, I almost forgot. There's a note I'm supposed to read. And it says here, Ray says, wear this and nothing else for me this evening.
The sulky stared at the ground, as if embarrassed. Brigetta laughed and undid the safety chain.
That's Ray, all right.
She opened the door. People were so gullible. Wednesday, October 6th, 11:46 a.m., Quantico. Alex Michaels was on his way to the cafeteria, though he wasn't really very hungry. The hot leads of just 2 days ago had petered out. Jay Gridley's widow of programmers living in Russia had come up blank, and the DNA and fingerprints of the woman who had collected Scout at a New York hotel hadn't found a match on any of the systems they had checked. Tony Fiorella had, it seemed to Michaels, been avoiding him. She'd missed a staff meeting, left early, and generally looked at him as if he'd developed some highly contagious disease. But Jay Gridley came bustling up, grinning.
Tell me you've got good news, and that raise is a done deal.
Let me see. Got the programmer. How's that?
No.
Yep. I was right. He's a Russian.
Jay held up his flat screen so the image on it was visible.
Commander, meet Vladimir Polekhanov.
Wednesday, October 6th, 3:30 p.m., New York City. Genaloni glanced at the clock on his desk. He waved the intercom on.
Roger, get the car. We're going out to Brigetta's.
Yes, sir.
Wednesday, October 6th, 3:40 p.m., Long Island. Brigetta had been extremely cooperative. Now she turned those sweet cornflower blue eyes on the selkie and said,
Are you going to kill me, too? Why should I? You do what you're supposed to do. Genaloni goes down. I'm gone. He'll have bodyguards with him. How many? A couple.
Apparently being cooperative again, but lying. Genaloni would have at least four guards. Five, if you counted his driver.
You don't seem too upset that your ride is about to get erased. I don't figure I'll have much trouble getting another, honey. If it was good enough for Genaloni, there will be other mob guys who'll want a taste.
The selkie grinned. Could she trust her?
Uh-uh.
She had no doubt that her target's mistress would sing an entire opera when asked by those who wanted to hear it. Still, Brigetta would be helpful. The Walther TPH-22 pistol the selkie held was kind of a scaled-down version of James Bond's PPK. But the tiny 22 round was not a man-stopper out of a pistol unless it hit the central nervous system. No. With a 22 handgun, you wanted to put the muzzle an inch or two from the back of the target's head and pump three or four sound-suppressed rounds into the hind brain while his bodyguards were sitting in their cars unaware, and be long gone before anybody came knocking. She needed privacy to do this right. Brigetta would get Genaloni into the house. Once the door was closed behind him, the selkie would handle the rest. Wednesday, October 6th, 6 p.m., Quantico. The 5 o'clock meeting began an hour late. This was a small group. Michaels, Tony, Jay, Colonel Howard, and the new FBI computer liaison, Richardson.
All right, Michaels said. You've all gotten the info packet Jay put together. Any questions?
Richardson said,
Yes, once you've done a verification that this Plekhanov is for certain the programmer we want, how do we proceed?
Jay nodded.
Plekhanov probably has a standby security program for his most sensitive files. If we don't get the files, we can't prove it's him. Not enough for the legal guys to ask for indictments. So, how do you do it? The ideal way is to look over his shoulder while he's got his system lit. Either that, or get the key.
And that's only part of the problem. Turns out he's got links to some pretty high government officials all over. And he's got money. That bank robbery in New Orleans probably wasn't his first.
Howard said,
If this guy's rich and powerful, why is he doing this? Why take the risk? More money, more power. He's greedy.
Probably, Michaels said. But I've been going over the information. And what it seems like to me is that he's driving at something specific.
Before he could continue, the door to the conference room opened. Michael's secretary stood there.
Commander, there's some news from New York you need to hear. It's about Ray Gentiloni.
Wednesday, October 6th, 4:40 p.m., Long Island. Brigitte's doorbell rang.
Go let him in. If there are any sudden moves, anything at all, I'll drop you before I do anything else.
Okay, I understand.
Brigitte headed for the door. The Selkie moved back out of sight, the pistol held in both hands by her right ear, muzzle pointed at the ceiling. She took a deep breath, let it out slowly. Adrenaline surged over her in warm rushes. Gentiloni and Brigitte walked past her hiding place, never glanced in her direction. The Selkie stepped out behind them as they entered the kitchen.
Hands high and wide, Gentiloni.
He obeyed.
Can I turn around?
Sure.
He did.
You must be the Selkie, right? Why this?
Your people tried to find me. You were told a long time ago that's not allowed.
Shit, they were supposed to be good.
Not good enough.
The tiny bullet hit Ray Gentiloni in the white of his right eye. He went boneless and fell, brain shorted out by the lead bouncing around inside his skull.
Oh, Jesus!
Brigitte said.
Oh, Jesus!
The Selkie said,
calm down. You're all right. Who's that at the door?
Brigitte turned to look. The Selkie fired twice, spat, spat, and double-tapped Brigitte in the right temple. The Selkie moved fast. She bent, put two more shots into the back of Brigitte's head, then two more in the back of Ray's skull. She looked around. She hadn't left any prints anywhere. Okay, now the second part. She moved to the back door, peeped through a gap in the blinds covering the window next to the door. A big man in a gray sweatsuit stood inside the fence next to the gate. He had a belly pouch drooped heavy over his crotch. That's where he'd have his gun. She had spent the better part of the day with Brigitte. She could do enough of an imitation of her voice to fool somebody who might have heard it no more than a couple of times. She took a deep breath, opened the door.
Excuse me, could you come here for a second? Ray needs a hand.
As the sweat-suited bodyguard ambled toward the back door, the Selkie stepped out into the yard. She squeezed off her first shot before the guy got past the frown. The second and third rounds followed so fast they sounded like one long brap. She tapped him three times in the head, then ran for the back fence. She got to it at speed, put her hands, including the pistol, on top, and jumped and levered herself over it. A pretty good hop. She ran to the gate next to the house, opened it, closed it behind her. 45 seconds later, she was in the van, started it, backed out into the street, then pulled away. She drove without any particular haste, stopped at the stop sign, a model driver. Ray Gentiloni was no longer a worry. Now she had to go back to Washington to finish one more little chore. Thursday, October 7th, 1:45 a.m., Grozny. As he was rebuilding his system, damaged in the sudden VR bail he'd been forced to take, Plekhanov came across bad news. Somebody had snapped a couple of his tripwires. He re-ran his security scans. There were no other signs of the intruder, so he was good, whoever he was. But there was no way to avoid breaking the trip if he went down certain electronic corridors. He was sure that it was a NetForce operative, using the information gathered during the chase. So, either they knew who he was, or they were close to figuring it out. If it was still the latter, with the resources of NetForce at their disposal, it would be only a matter of time. And then, then was when it would get interesting. They had no hard evidence, he was certain of that. And in order to get such evidence, they would have to probe a lot deeper into his system than they could possibly have managed thus far. A blot on an otherwise perfect plan, but not crippling, not this far along. Past a certain point, nothing they did would matter, and that point was fast approaching. Wednesday, October 6th, 7:06 p.m., Quantico. Michaels was still chewing on the news that Ray Gentiloni was dead, along with his mistress and a bodyguard, as he wound the meeting down. He said to Howard,
I need you to do something for me. Work up a plan that would involve a sub-rosa extraction of Plekhanov from Chechnya.
Howard stared at him.
Sir?
Assume for a second that we can't get the Russian legally extradited. What would it take for a team to go in and get him? Could it be done? Howard didn't hesitate.
Yes, sir, it could be done.
Dog tags, under civilian clothes. Some kind of contingency plan if the extraction went sour. This is your area of expertise.
Sir, I'll work it up ASAP.
Thank you, Colonel. Michaels went back to his office. Tony walked along with him. If Genaloni had Steve Day killed, he's beyond our reach now, she said. He frowned. Somebody very professional did this. An expert. We're talking about somebody with super-cooled liquid in their veins. Our forensic report is still preliminary. All we got is a boot print in the neighbor's yard. Depth in the ground says he weighed maybe 115, 120. Cat burglar build. Something occurred to him. What size did you say this killer's shoe was? 4 or 5? Let me ask you a question. Women's shoes and men's shoes, how do they compare size-wise? Depends on the cut and make, but usually the woman's shoe will be a couple of numbers larger than the same size in a man's. Yeah. According to the computer extrapolation on the woman who picked up the dog in New York, that woman wears a 6 and weighs between 115 and 125 pounds. You think it's the same person? Coincidence only stretches so far. But if she was working for Genaloni... Exactly. Why kill him? Maybe he didn't want to pay her for missing you. Maybe, but it doesn't feel right. What if we're wrong about who had Steve Day killed? His assassination was by a team, and it was planned okay, but the execution was sloppy. A bunch of guys with submachine guns spraying all over the place. Doesn't seem like this woman's style. She seems more adept than that. So, what are you saying here? There are 2 sets of killers? It's a possibility. What if it wasn't connected to organized crime at all? Okay, let's assume for a second you're right. Why would anybody want to take you out? What did Day and I have in common? Net Force. What if the attacks weren't on us personally, but on the heads of Net Force? From 2 different sets of killers? Yes. There was a quick knock. They looked up to see Jay Gridley standing there. What's up, Jay?
Put in for my raise, boss. We got her. The assassin. A positive ID.
Thursday, October 7th, 8:48 p.m., Quantico. Tony sat in her office, looking at the information Jay had developed. The fingerprints of the suspected assassin belonged to Maura Sullivan, an Irish national, the daughter of an IRA man killed by the British. What they had was her age, nationality, and natural hair and eye color, along with her prints. Not a lot of help in recognizing her, given her ability with disguises. Tony's phone announced an incoming call. Her stomach twisted. Rusty.
Guru Tony, how are you?
Fine. Busy. I'm not going to be able to get to the gym for a workout today. Too much going on. But I can break loose for a few minutes around lunch today, if you want to grab a quick cup of coffee.
That would make my day.
She winced at how happy he seemed when she said it. It would make his day all right, but not in the way he thought.
How about Heidi's?
This was a coffee shop near the complex.
Great. See you then.
They discommed. Tony blew out a big sigh and stared at nothing.
Yeah, great.
Somebody somewhere had surely written a book on how to tell a man you still liked but didn't want to sleep with again that you still liked him but didn't want to sleep with him again. The problem was, he hadn't said or done anything wrong. It wasn't his fault. But it didn't matter what Rusty thought. He didn't have any choice. It was a done deal, not open to negotiation, end of discussion, so sorry. She didn't want to hurt him, but it was either cut him off clean with a sudden slash or poke him with a needle and let him slowly bleed out. She had been taught to face things head on, to move in close, and do what was needed to finish things. It was more dangerous, but it was quicker and cleaner. Quicker. Cleaner. Harder. She was not looking forward to it. Thursday, October 7th, 8:56 p.m., Quantico. John Howard stood in his office, pacing, while the computer put together yet another scenario for the theoretical snatch of the Russian programmer. The big elements were stable, but the small variables were always the problem.
A straight-up firefight in a big field in the middle of nowhere was easy. But what, for instance, could you do to predict the traffic pattern on the streets of any large city during a covert operation? Plus, the snatch was only one element. A small unit, 3 or 4 troops, no more, would handle that. But if the operation went south, how many men were necessary for a backup team? Did the NetForce team want to begin a firefight with troops of a supposedly friendly nation? The computer chimed. The new OP was done. Chance of success, 54%. Might as well flip a coin for that one. Computer, retain previous parameters. Change operation begin time to 2300 hours and run. He paced. He did not have much confidence that Michaels would give the order to use military intervention in this situation. He had too many people to answer to higher up the chain of command. Still, he had his orders. He would carry them out to the best of his ability. He was a soldier. That was what he did. Thursday, October 7th, 9:02 p.m., Washington, D.C. The Selke couldn't expect the teams guarding the target to use the same route to his condo twice in a row. However, the closer they got, the fewer options they had. There were only 2 main approaches to the neighborhood, and if they didn't use this one today, they would likely use it tomorrow. She got lucky. Today they picked this route. She stood at a public phone kiosk a mile away from Michael's place. She was dressed as a man, in boots, baggy jeans, an oversized jacket, with a short and well-trimmed fake beard. As she'd expected, they had ramped up the level of protection. And these guys would be quicker on the draw than a mobster's bodyguard. They'd be firing as soon as they spotted her. Given the location and logistics of the neighborhood, the Selke eliminated the target's condo as a place to do the deletion. Trying for a hit on a convoy was also risky. Rockets were iffy. She had heard of cases where missiles had hit ordinary windshield glass at an angle and bounced off without exploding. And as for a bomb, a big enough charge to be sure of a kill would probably be picked up by an electronic sniffer or even a bomb dog. Besides, given how she had failed before, she wanted to do this up close and personal. The cane was out, but a knife or bare hands had a certain appeal. The only viable alternative for a deletion now was to do it where the target wouldn't be constantly surrounded by guards, and in such a way that nobody would know he'd been hit until she had plenty of time to get away. Given her options, the only place that would fit was a place considered secure. She'd have to kill him inside NetForce headquarters. Friday, October 8th, 9:05 a.m., Quantico. Getting yourself or some illegal object into a secure area when you weren't supposed to was not as hard as most people would like to believe. Offhand, the Selke knew of at least 4 ways to smuggle a firearm onto a plane. The little pistol she now had tucked into the waistband of her pantyhose was a 3-shooter with triple-stack 2-inch barrels. At close range, the non-metal gun would kill a man as dead as the biggest steel cowboy 6-shooter ever made. The piece wouldn't pass a hard object scan, but standing on its end, it would likely skate by a fluoro scanner, and it would go through any standard security metal detector on the planet without a blip. Strapped to her right inner thigh, almost to her groin, was a sheath knife, also of ceramic, full tang, with a plastic handle. NetForce was a level 3 through level 1 building. That meant that getting into the building itself needed only L3 techniques. More private areas would have tighter wards, palm or retinal scanners, knuckle readers, vox codes, and such. With even the smallest computer knowledge, it was easy enough to find low-level employees, secretaries, receptionists, maintenance people, who had worked for NetForce only a short time. Thus it was that Christine Wesson, a not-too-ugly brunette with brown eyes, aged 29, came to the end of her short and probably undistinguished life. And now, a woman who looked enough like Wesson to pass for her to anybody who didn't know her very well, wearing her clothes, was inside NetForce HQ. Christine herself was wrapped in plastic bags in her bathtub, under 100 or so pounds of melting, crushed ice. Sooner or later, of course, the office where Wesson worked would probably notice she had not shown up. They might call her apartment and get the answering machine. No problem, unless for some reason those concerned thought to check the building's security computer. To stall that, the Selke had asked more or less politely if Christine would call her supervisor in the office supply section in which she worked and tell her she would be a few hours late.
Then a timed email would show up at the supervisor's terminal from Wesson, explaining that things had run long, a lot longer than anybody but the Selkie knew. At the least, the email would buy the rest of the day, which should be more than enough. Friday, October 8th, 12:18 p.m., Quantico. Tony went through her juros. She was the only woman working out. There were a few other men in the gym today, but Rusty was not among them. When she'd told him she wasn't going to be sleeping with him anymore, she thought he'd taken it rather well. No obvious anger, no tears, just a kind of surprised acceptance. A brunette in office clothes walked to the water fountain, smiled, and nodded at Tony, then went into the locker room. Tony dismissed her from her thoughts, but a moment later, the brunette came out, all upset. "Excuse me, miss. There's a lady having some trouble in there. She looks like she's having some kind of seizure. Can you help?" Tony nodded. "Sure." She followed the brunette into the locker room. Friday, October 8th, 12:18 p.m., Quantico. Jay Gridley and John Howard had joined Michaels in the small conference room.
"Jay?" "Okay, boss, here's the way it lays out. It looks as if Plekhanov's been trying to buy himself a government or two. We think he's got a good chance of deciding who the president and prime ministers for two, maybe three, CIS governments are going to be."
Michaels said, "You think he's planning some kind of coup?"
Jay shrugged. "Given the way this guy moves, yeah, I'd have to say it's a possibility."
"Colonel?"
"My best-case scenario for the operation to collect Mr. Plekhanov comes in at 78%.
"I want to see it."
"Sir, right here."
His secretary came in. "Commander, Tony Fiorella on the private line." He waved her off.
"Gentlemen, let me take this call." "Hello?"
"Commander Michaels, this is Christine Wesson from Supply. I was working out in the gym, and Sub-Commander Fiorella asked me to call you. She's had an accident. Medical is on the way, but I think maybe she's got a broken leg."
"A broken leg?"
"One of the exercise machines fell over on her. Between you and me, she's in a lot of pain."
"I'm on my way."
The two men looked up at him.
"You two put your heads together and see what more sense you can make out of this mess. I'll be back in a few minutes."
"Sure thing, boss."
"Sir."
Michaels started for the hall. Friday, October 8th, 12:28 p.m., Quantico. Half in and half out of the shower stall, the Selkie held the gun aimed at the woman sitting cross-legged on the tile floor inside. Fiorella twitched.
"Keep your hands on your head," the Selkie said. "You can't get away with this."
"Uh-huh.
You're not as good as you think, Maura Sullivan."
That surprised her. How the hell had they found that out? She had a quick spasm of panic, fought it down. Sullivan was just another name now, one more disposable ID. Still.
"We're going to have a little talk before I leave," the Selkie said.
The woman was scared, and well she should be, but she said,
"I don't think so."
Another gutsy woman. Damn. Too bad she had to kill her.
"Tony,"
came a voice from outside the locker room's door.
"In here,"
the Selkie said.
"Hurry!"
She heard the sound of fast footsteps.
She grinned.
Friday, October 8th, 8:37 p.m., Grozny. Plekhanov didn't need to use VR to see that tripwires were broken all over his walkways. They knew who he was, and they were probing every aspect of his life they could reach. He didn't think they could find much, but he would add one more piece of insurance, something to make them think. One more obstacle to make certain they stumbled and could not recover in time to catch him. He put in a call to the rifle. Friday, October 8th, 12:37 p.m., Quantico. Give him credit, the Selkie thought. As soon as he saw the gun, he knew what was going on.
"Move, and she dies."
The target nodded.
"I understand. I'm not armed."
Tony sat very still, watching. She was going to have to make her move soon. She could come up from a cross-legged sit, had done it in practice thousands of times. If the woman was 6 inches closer, she could reach her with a kick. If. Tony inhaled slowly, held it, made herself ready.
"Don't move, FBI!"
somebody yelled. Tony looked at the reflection in the shower door. Rusty. The Selkie reacted without thinking. The little gun bucked hard in her hand, and she saw the man react as the shot took him in the center of mass. The target lunged at her, screaming something. She thrust the pistol at him and fired.
no! The woman in the shower screamed. Then she slammed into the Selkie, and they both went flying. The Selkie grabbed the knife and jerked it from the thigh sheath. The Fiorella woman was the danger. She was up, trained, prepared. The Selkie turned to face her. Michaels felt the bullet hit him against the front of his right thigh. The shot leg didn't want to work. In front of him, Tony faced the woman. He had to do something. The gun. She had dropped the gun. Where was it? The Selkie moved in, keeping her balance. Fiorella stood and watched her, waiting. The Selkie fainted with a kick, then lunged. Tony shifted her stance and did the block and break on the attacker's knife arm. Her right arm stopped the thrust at the wrist, low. Blood flew from a cut on her arm as she slammed the back of her left wrist under the woman's elbow, high. The arm broke. The knife fell. The Selkie knew now she couldn't take Fiorella in a one-on-one, even if her arm hadn't just been broken. One chance. She dived for the knife, caught it in her good hand, came up, and cocked the blade for a throw. Michaels found the gun and yelled to distract the woman about to throw the knife. She didn't waver. He pulled the trigger. The knife flew, but clattered to the floor 5 feet away. He'd hit her. She turned to look at him, her face puzzled more than anything. Then she toppled over onto her side. Tony got to her feet and remembered Rusty. His eyes were open wide, not blinking. There was no pulse in his neck. Alex dragged himself to where the woman lay. He rolled her onto her back. The assassin moaned.
Son of a bitch.
Her voice was burbly, probably bleeding into a lung.
Who paid you, Steve Day?
Was dying, but she laughed.
Who?
Steve Day.
I never forget a target. He's not one of mine. Genelloni, I did him and some others. I don't.
Whatever she intended to say was chopped off in mid-sentence. Somebody from medical ran in. The place seemed filled with people. Tony felt an overwhelming urge to hug Alex. She did. He let her, and he hugged her back. Friday, October 8th, 1:02 p.m., Quantico. The in-house medic sutured the cut on Tony's arm, sprayed it with clear stat skin, and gave her a tetanus shot. X-rays of Michael's leg showed that his bullet wound was a through-and-through without doing any major damage. They were back in Michael's office. He sat on the couch, resting on his good hip. Tony stood by the door.
I'm really sorry about your friend, the FBI trainee.
Yeah.
There was a long pause. Then...
You believe her? About Steve Day?
Tony shrugged. Why would she lie? Did you believe her?
Yeah, I did. I didn't think Day's murder was her style before, and this confirmed it for me.
So we're back to square one?
No. I know who did it.
She looked at him.
Who? The Russian, Plekhanov. It was part of his plan all along to give NetForce something else to look at while he pulled off his power grab. He was willing to crash systems that caused traffic and industrial deaths. It's not that big a leap to hiring a shooter.
Tony looked at him. Assume you're right. How do we prove it?
Plekhanov could open the files for us.
He has no reason to do that.
We'll have to figure out the right way to ask after we collect him.
Up-levels won't go for it, Alex. Walt Carver's too much a political animal to risk it.
This man had Steve Day murdered, and we can't get him because of some bureaucratic crap.
I know how you feel, but we'll be wasting our time to even ask.
Fine. So we won't ask.
Neither of them spoke for what seemed like a long time. Then Michaels said,
We'd better get John Howard in here.
You think he'll go along?
We won't tell him either. If anything happens... It's my head that will roll.
Saturday, October 9th, 5 a.m., in the air, over Hudson Bay.
All right, Sergeant, let's hear it.
Julio Fernandez grinned and affected his recruit to drillmaster voice.
Sir, Colonel Howard, sir, Chechnya is landlocked, bounded by Ingushetia on the west, Russia on the north, Dagestan on the east, and Georgia on the south. The western border of the country is about 300 kilometers east of the Black Sea. The capital and largest city is Grozny.
Let's get to strategy and tactics, please.
as the colonel wishes. Our two vintage UH-1H Hueys are scheduled to be offloaded at 1900 hours from jet transport at Vladikavkaz. At treetop level in the dark, it is unlikely that anybody but a few goats will even notice our chopper's overflight. It should be a milk run. We have a truck waiting in Grozny, which our four-trooper collection team squad will reach from Uris Martan upon the two Russian motor scooters we'll bring with us on the copters. We arrive, all things going well, at about 2200 hours, set up our tactical base in an old dairy farm. Everything going as planned, our CT squad putt-putts into town, collects their ride, grabs the Rusky, comes back, and a few minutes after midnight, we're all airborne.
If everything goes as planned.
You worry too much, sir. Our squad speaks fluent Russian. They got the proper travel and ID papers. They can shoot the balls off a gnat at 10 paces. They'll get him.
Saturday, October 9th, 10 a.m., Springfield, Virginia. Ruzio and Grigory the Snake were at a petrol service station off I-95, not far from the Springfield Regional Shopping Center. Winters, the Texan, had gone home. They had stopped because Grigory had an urgent need to use the toilet. From the muffled groans he had made as he urinated, Ruzio guessed that Zmia's own personal snake was afflicted with some ailment. Here was his reward for his adventures in Las Vegas. Grigory came out of the toilet, his face flushed.
I need some penicillin, Mikhail. There's a pet store nearby. We can get it there.
A pet store?
Da. The Americans have rules against selling antibiotics for people, but not for animals.
Ruzio stared at the snake.
Very well. We shall go to your pet store so that you may buy fish medicine to fix your sick Zmia. Then we find a way to get within range of NetForce HQ. Anything you like, Mikhail, once I get my penicillin.
Saturday, October 9th, 10:48 p.m., Uris Martan, Chechnya. Howard looked at his watch, then through the dilapidated farmhouse's window.
Status, Sergeant?
Julio stood behind three TACCOM specialists, who sat on stools in front of a bank of 5 field computers set up on their own telescoping legs, state-of-the-art 900 megahertz machines with the new FireEye bio-neuro chips.
Sir, our squad's GPS SIG puts them 2 kilometers from their destination.
Report.
All systems green.
Good.
One of the TCS operators said, "We got online vid from the Big Bird SpySat, footprinting the locale." A crude, hand-drawn image, sharpened enough that Howard could make it out. It was a hand holding up the 2-finger sign for the letter V. V for victory. Howard smiled. No matter where they were, no matter what they were up against, soldiers always found some way to relieve the monotony or the tension. Saturday, October 9th, 11:23 p.m., Grozny. Plekhanov was getting ready for bed when the doorbell to his house rang. It was awfully late for someone to be calling. This could not be good news. Pistol in hand, he peered through the fisheye lens inset into the door. A very attractive young woman stood on the stoop. Her hair was in disarray, and her lipstick smeared. Her dark blouse was pulled out of her pants, unbuttoned and wide open. A rape victim? Plekhanov lowered the gun and opened the door.
Yes? May I help you?
A man appeared from out of nowhere and pointed a gun at Plekhanov's face.
Yes, sir, you can help us.
He spoke Russian, but it wasn't a local accent.
If you would step back inside, Dr. Plekhanov,
the gunman said. His speech was correct, but Plekhanov still had not placed the accent.
You aren't Russian, nor Chechen.
No, sir.
This was spoken in English. Plekhanov's stomach twisted. They were Americans.
Inside, Professor. You'll want to change into something more appropriate for travel. We're going on a long trip.
Saturday, October 9th, 11:28 p.m., Uris Martan.
They got him. ETA, 20 minutes.
The men in the room cheered. Howard let them, then said,
All right, get the birds online. We'll celebrate when we're back on our own soil.
10 minutes later, Fernandez came out of the farmhouse, double time.
Sir, we have a slight problem. Our squad's ride just broke down. Squad leader Captain Marcus says he thinks it blew a head gasket.
Howard stared at him. The truck broke down.
That wasn't even in the scenario. Jesus Christ.
Sunday, October 10th, 12:04 a.m., Uris Martin.
Where are they?
Sir, GPS puts them in the city, close to the Shunsa River.
How far from here?
I make it 18 kilometers. Uh-oh, we've got incoming Vox transmission. This is Alpha Wolf, Cub. Go ahead.
Sir, we're broken down in the middle of a giant oil tank farm, and we've got two security officers 100 meters away approaching us on bicycles.
Bike cops. Great. Follow planned procedure. Smile politely and wave your documents. They'll pass muster.
Yes, sir. Oh, shit. Alpha, we have a situation here. Our passenger started screaming bloody murder, and these stupid damned cops just up and opened fire.
Howard waited what seemed like a couple of thousand years. Captain Marcus came back online.
Sir, the downed local is defunct. He had a belt phone. I would guess that we're going to have unfriendly company soon. Please advise.
Howard looked at Fernandez. There was no choice.
Bag it up, troops. We lift in 3 minutes.
Howard and Fernandez ran for the helicopters. Saturday, October 9th, 5:20 p.m., Quantico. Michaels and Tony were in the small conference room working on their second pot of coffee.
You saved my life in that locker room,
Alex said.
If you hadn't jumped that woman, she would have killed me.
Rusty saved us both. I'd never have gotten to her if he hadn't come in and started yelling.
I'm really sorry about Agent Russell. I knew you were teaching him your fighting art. Were you, close?
She hesitated for a moment.
Not really, no.
He sipped at the coffee.
I wonder how it's going. They're supposed to be done about now.
I'm sure they'll call as soon as they can.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I am confident that Colonel Howard will execute his mission.
Where was Howard? He should have called by now. He looked at his watch. Even if it all went as smooth as silk on silk, Michaels was going to have to do some fast and fancy dancing to keep Carver from going for his throat when he found out. If they went through all this and failed to retrieve Plekhanov, well, he was definitely going to be in crap up to his eyebrows. Sunday, October 10th, 12:12 a.m., Grozny.
She's at top speed now, sir,
the pilot yelled. He had to yell to be heard over the Huey's rotor and wind noise. All those action vids where they showed people having normal conversations inside a big chopper with the doors open, like it was two aristocrats sharing tea in an air-conditioned Rolls-Royce, those were pure fantasy. These were vids produced by somebody who had probably never even seen a helicopter close up. Even the radio chatter in the headphones was hard to hear.
How long?
Howard shouted.
2-3 minutes. There's the edge of the tank farm, ahead, to the right. And there's the river. I'm going to take us right over the main road.
The 10 men assigned to this craft carried H&K subguns and holstered sidearms, 9mm Brownings, along with cold steel sheath knives. They wore plain coveralls, but they also wore flak vests and generic Kevlar helmets and boots. The troops did wear dog tags, but that didn't matter. They weren't leaving any personnel behind. Either they all left or they all stayed.
There's the truck,
Fernandez yelled.
And there's trouble.
A convoy of military-style vehicles, 3 of them, was fast approaching the dead truck from the other direction. Howard yelled at the pilot.
Will my headset reach C2?
Yes, sir, it should.
C2, this is Alpha Wolf. Do you copy?
Alpha Wolf, we copy. You're trans.
C2, I want you to stand away. Repeat, stand away. No point in giving them 2 targets.
Yes, sir.
To his pilot, Howard said,
put it down, Lute, between our truck and the incoming.
Yes, sir.
Howard's stomach lurched as the bird dropped toward the road. He felt his skin tighten.
Nobody fires unless fired on. Deploy in a staggered grid and stand ready.
Howard looked at the uprushing road. No cover, but he wouldn't start blasting in the middle of an oil tank field if it was his property. He was banking on the Chechen force commander's surprise and sense of responsibility. The Huey touched down.
Lock and load,
Howard yelled. He checked his own weapon to make sure it was ready, then went out to collect his squad and their catch. Sunday, October 10th, 12:18 a.m., Grozny. The 3 Chechen vehicles skidded to a halt as Howard and his troops piled out of the Huey and spread out.
There were 15, maybe 18 Chechens in military gear, and they deployed, pointing their weapons from behind the Jeep clone, the van, and police car.
Marcus,
Howard said, quietly enough so he hoped his voice wouldn't carry to the Chechens.
Get the package into the bird, and then get out here.
Slowly and carefully, Howard triggered his comm headset, opened the op-chan to the second Huey.
C-2, respond.
Copy, Alpha. This is C-2.
We need a distraction here. There's a big van with a flashing blue light, about 60 meters north of our position, next to C-1. I would appreciate it if you would approach from the north and have somebody lean out and put a couple of magazines of hardball into the roof of that vehicle.
Consider it a done deal, Alpha.
Give me an ETA.
45 seconds, sir.
We are leaving, troops,
Howard said, loud enough for his force to hear.
On my command, by twos, as fast as you can.
In the reflected light from the Chechen vehicles and the yellow sodium lamps outlining the oil tanks, Howard saw the Huey roar in. After a beat, the rapid yellow-orange flashes of two or three submachine guns blasted from the open doorway. The Chechens turned to face the new and more active threat.
Go, go, go!
Howard's troops piled into the Huey.
Lift, lift!
The pilot powered up, and the Huey lurched into the sky. Howard yelled into his mic.
C-2.
Right behind you, Alpha.
Casualties your way?
Negative, sir.
Sergeant?
Anybody hit?
Fernandez yelled. Apparently nobody was.
This is kidnapping. You can't do this.
Howard regarded the indignant Russian. He felt a cold hatred fill him as he looked at the man.
Your fools will create an international incident. I have influential friends. You cannot expect to get away with it.
Howard stared at the man.
We already have gotten away with it. Mister, you killed a man I liked and respected. If you don't shut up right now, you might accidentally fall out of this thing. At this speed and height, you will bounce like a rubber ball when you hit the ground.
The Russian apparently decided he had nothing else to say. Saturday, October 9th, 6:54 p.m., Quantico. The phone rang in the conference room. Alone, Michaels grabbed it.
Right here, Colonel.
Mission accomplished, sir.
Tony came back into the room. Michaels broke the connection, grinned at Tony.
They got him. Be here tomorrow.
I'll give Jay Gridley a call, she said. He wanted to know how it came out.
Do that.
So, now what, Alex?
Back to business as usual, I guess. If I survive the meeting with Carver when I tell him what I did.
You will. The director looks at the bottom line. Our current president wanted this guy caught. He's caught.
And all in all, we didn't do too bad, did we?
No, we didn't do too bad.
They grinned at each other. Sunday, October 10th, 11:30 a.m., Quantico. Ruzio, dressed in fatigues of a United States Marine sergeant, stood outside and next to the chain-link fence that surrounded the Net Force HQ building. The rifle was a Remington, and not a Winchester, but it was also .30-06 caliber and a bolt action. If the Net Force commander did not come out for lunch, Ruzio would leave, then cycle back later to see if he could catch him departing for the day. If he did not spot him then, perhaps he would set up along his route home. There was always somewhere. A plain white Dodge van with government plates pulled up near the entrance. The door to the building opened, and an attractive brunette emerged. Immediately behind her was Alexander Michaels. There he was. Ruzio placed the wavering crosshairs on the man's chest. He allowed half of his indrawn breath to escape, began his squeeze. Shit! Ruzio took his finger from the trigger. The military man held a man by the arm. The man he held was Vladimir Plekhanov. Should he shoot Michaels, or should he shoot Plekhanov? The man might give him up when questioned. Ruzio knew well there were drugs, instruments that could pry secrets from the tightest lips. No, he would not kill Vladimir. And as for the Net Force commander, there was no point in shooting him now either. It would not help Plekhanov. It would serve no purpose. He pulled the rifle from the fence, bent, put it into the duffel bag. He zipped the bag closed, stood. A bus approached. He would take it, rent another car in the next town, drive, and find a place to sit and think. The bus hissed to a stop, the door accordioned open. The driver smiled at him. Ruzio returned a smaller smile,
but it was more for the thought that crossed his mind than anything else. At least he would never again have to listen to Grigory, the snake. And by the time somebody opened the rental car's trunk and discovered what lay therein, Ruzio would be far, far away. In the desert, perhaps.